High Desert and the great American Southwest. Happy to you all. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be across this great world of ours. Actually, that's the kind of coverage we have. How you doing, everybody? I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, 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 what a surprise. Here I am again. Well, in defense of myself, when I last retired, Michael Jordan-like, I did say, never say never. This time is the last time I was smart enough, never say never, right? So how did this happen anyway, you might be wondering. So I'll tell you. Here's how it happened. Here I was, happily retired, 7-8 months later. And I got a call from the relentless AAA-type person out down in Los Angeles, known as Robin Bertolucci, who is the director of all things in programming for the mighty KFI in Los Angeles, one of the biggest in the country. And she said, hey, Art, how about come back and do a show for KFI? And I said, Robin, I'm retired. She said, yeah, I know. How about come back and do a show? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm retired. I don't know. And then I started thinking, well, you know, I told her I was trying to come up with something. I said, look, it would be as hard for me to do a show for KFI as it would be if I, you know, as I think about it, to do it for, you know, 300, 500 stations, whatever. Because you wouldn't do any less work to prepare for a single show as you would for a show for everybody. So I said, you know, if I'm going to do it on one, I might as well do it on all, huh? She said, well, then, how about if I call up the network? I said, sure, have at it, you know, thinking nothing would come of it, right? Well, 5 minutes later, the telephone rings. It's the president of the network, Craig Kitchen, who says, hey, you want to do weekends? I said, I don't know. I said, this is happening because of, you know, our little Miss Type A down there at KFI. And he said, yeah, well, you want to do it? I said, well, I'll tell you what. Give me a couple days to think about it, talk to my wife, and we'll see. So I thought about it for actually quite a few days. And I thought, why not? I suppose I was born to do this, so why not? I'll do it. And that's how it happened. That's exactly how it happened. And then I put a little hint up on the web, and all I did was I did a little graphic up on the web that said mysterious and reassuring. And I never said what that meant. Now, in the press release from Premier Radio Networks, when they asked me for a comment, I said something like, my return to the air is both mysterious and reassuring for me. I'm stuck on that phrase lately. I really like it. I'll tell you where it comes from. There is a pretty cool show on Showtime called Dead Like Me with, I think her name is Ellen Muff or something, and she plays a character named George. And George is dead. George was hit at a tender early age of, I don't know, 19 or 20 or something, by a reentering Russian toilet seat from a space station. That was it. She's dead. And when she died, she became a reaper. And her job is to go around and collect souls from people who die violently, you know, tenderly taking the soul out of the body just minutes before a truck comes along and, you know, whatever. You know, the knife blade falls from the wall and beheads you or whatever awful is going to happen to account for your demise. She retrieves your soul mercifully moments before that. And it's a pretty interesting show if you get a chance to check it out on Showtime. At any rate, during one of the episodes of that show, Dead Like Me, she was working, yes, even in the afterlife as a reaper, you have to work. So she was working for a company called Happy Times, and, you know, she had her little cubicle like everybody does in those sorts of businesses, right? And they were having their little company party, and she was required to make a scrapbook. And, of course, her other job as Reaper, why, she would take pictures of people before they died, and then the manner of their death. And so her scrapbook for Happy Times, probably not very appropriate, was entitled Mysterious and Reassuring. And not exactly the kind of scrapbook Happy Times had in mind. However, her scrapbook contained, you know, on the first page, there was the picture of all these people during their lives when they were happy, I guess, right? And then when she would flip the page, it showed the manner of their deaths. I mean, it was terrible. It showed body parts and stuff like that. Anyway, so she held up her scrapbook, and it said, mysterious and reassuring. And she said, all these people, they all have it. The reassuring part is what lulls you into a sense that everything's going to be fine. And then, boom, they pull the rug out from underneath you. That's the mystery part. I guess meaning, you know, what is life all about? I mean, everything's going along just fine. And then, phew, they yank the rug out from under you. And there you are, in pieces. That's where the mysterious and reassuring part came from. All right, in a moment, we will do several things, look around the world. Later, James McCanney will be here tonight. It should be very interesting how our sun and the energy from it and or whatever goes on Earth or the mechanics of planets or whatever affects our weather. Been plenty of that lately with Isabel, right? So in a moment, or next hour, we'll do that. In a moment, we'll take a look around the world and see what's going on, if anything of interest at all. By the way, my pretties, that's interesting. We only needed one of those, just one. Barbara, who would normally have been here on the weekends, is on KSFO Radio in San Francisco with her regular show. And she's also, you might want to know, on retainer, to fill in for either George or myself. I'll have, I am told, 4 weekends every year, during which I need not be here, and Barb will be. And then, of course, she'll fill in for George, as I might as well. But she is on retainer to continue to do that. Now, I have revived, or I should say the good people at the Coast to Coast AM website have revived a couple of items for me, which you will find on the website right now. Number one is a webcam. It's kind of an interesting story behind the webcam, and I won't tell it all for bandwidth reasons, but there's a webcam up there, which is sort of coming from somewhere else, and a lot of people are going to say, well, what's that? It says W6OBB. Those are my ham call letters on the bottom. So that's going to be the webcam, and I can change that, and then I think it changes every half hour or so up there, according to whatever I've got back here. So the webcam is up there, and we have re-added the incredible Fast Blast. Fast Blast is back. Now, Fast Blast is the opportunity for you to go up to the website, click on that, and then every 30 minutes or so, not more than that, but about every, 30 minutes, you can send a message to me, you know, preferably with an intelligent question for me or the guest or whatever happens to be going on at the time, if you want to relate to it or whatever, you can, and I've got the computer right next to me, and I can just glance over and look at what, here's somebody, here's Tim, who says, welcome back on a regular basis, Art. I didn't tell anyone you were coming back because I was afraid JC might find out. See, I just read you one there cold. But someone will tell him sooner or later anyway. Oh, well, it's good to have you back. So that kind of thing, hopefully relevant questions for the guest and that sort of thing can pop up on that screen. But it's great to have a direct connection to all of you, and we have that back. It's all up on the website right now. Ramona and the 4 fur bags are just spiffy. They're fine. I'm always open, I want to add this, to any guest suggestions you might have. If you have any ideas, guest suggestions, grumbles, want to raise hell with me, which a lot of people do, that's okay. Here's my email address for that purpose, and it also is up on the website. It's artbell@mindspring.com. That simple. Artbell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L at mindspring.com. And that's on the website as well. Okay. Now, let's look around the world briefly. Unbowed by arguments with allies, President Bush is going to challenge the UN with a call to action. He would like money and troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite lingering differences and a reluctance by many countries to make major contributions. So at first we were going to go it alone. Now we're thinking, no, we could use the help of others. Waiting lines lengthened and frustration mounted Saturday as people living along the hundreds of miles damaged in Hurricane Isabel's floods and winds realized that it could be days before their next hot bath or even home-cooked meal. The huge storm knocked out electrical service for about 6 million homes and businesses from North Carolina's Outer Banks to New York. This was it was a strange hurricane, wasn't it? Very violent while out in the Atlantic, then going down to a strong Category 2, but still doing an awful lot of damage. No question about it. A six gunman firing assault weapons from a Toyota pickup chased a member of Iraq's governing council in her car, seriously wounding her in the first assassination attempt targeting the U.S.-created leadership body there in Iraq. Now, a few items. This really caught my attention, and it is not at all reassuring. It's about a book called Adam's Curse. Now, I sat straight up when I heard this on CNN, seems like about a week ago, and I am pursuing a guest on this subject. But, I mean, basically, here it is. Adam's Curse, why bother? Why by itself? The letter Y, bother. Men are doomed after all. Men are doomed to extinction, victims of the decaying human Y chromosome. The only piece of DNA men possess and women do not. So there you have it, guys. We have the Y chromosome. Girls, gals don't. And it is deteriorating. So says Brian Sykes. He's the guy I'm pursuing here. He's a professor of genetics at Oxford, and a book that envisages the sapphic reproduction of women by genetic manipulation. This is frightening stuff. A genetic ruin littered with molecular damage. The Y chromosome cannot repair itself nor arrest the steadily accumulating damage, he reports in Adam's Curse. Like the face of the moon, still pitted by all the craters from all the meteors that have ever fallen upon its surface, Y chromosomes cannot heal their own scars. It is a dying chromosome, and one day will become extinct. The decline of the Y chromosome has been well chronicled. What is new is Professor Sykes' description of the implications and the stark choices for all of the human race. He says that because the chromosome's main function is switching on male embryos in the womb, well, its demise means the final curtain for men. God, this is a terrible story. By his estimate, the male will go belly up, his words, in about 125,000 years. But he cautions ultra-feminists against rejoicing too much. He says destroying the male sex would be a very short-lived victory indeed. Men are still required for, well, breeding, if nothing else. But not for much longer. If Professor Sykes' radical solution is adopted, abandoning men altogether from the genetic point of view, very little stands in its way, says he. His strategy for perpetuating a new female race depends on tweaking the proven technique of injecting sperm into eggs. Instead, the nucleus from a second egg would be injected. The only difference from any other birth would be that the baby would always be a girl. No more blue, everything would be pink. The entire process has been accomplished without sperm, without Y chromosomes, and without men, says Professor Sykes. I mean, this story actually made me angry. The girls would not be clones, but instead would comprise the same mixture of their parents' genes, shuffled by recombination as today's children. But there would be one major difference. Both parents would be women. It is almost bound to happen, says the professor, who can find no moral objection. Men are now on notice, he says. However, Professor Sykes does not speculate on what would pass for sex once men disappear. Well, hey, good, professor. At least you got a problem with that. At least you're thinking ahead a little. But So I'll try to get this Sykes guy on. But what, Professor Sykes, I should be kind. What would a world without any man at all be like? It couldn't be too good a place, do you think? So I'd be happy to have your opinion on that. A world made up entirely of, well, chicks. Let's see, and going along with that, oh, here's some nice news for you. A cloning scientist created human cow embryos. Do you understand what we're talking about here? We're talking about half cow, half human. He's created an embryo, a half human, half cow embryo, containing DNA from both humans and cattle, which lived for several weeks and could have been implanted into a woman's womb. Oh, my God. Jonathan Leake of the UK Sunday Times writes that his name is Panayotis Zavos, made the hybrid embryos by inserting human DNA into the eggs of a cow. He did it in order to refine his cloning techniques, says he. Quote, we are not trying to create monsters, end quote. The embryo grew to several hundred cells, which is beyond the stage, by the way, known as differentiation, in which cells begin to develop into tissues and organs. Further studies of this sort are sure to be done. Besides enraging people who are against abortion, the creating of hybrids just troubles me. How about you? It's doubtful that such a hybrid could ever be born alive, but one never knows. So he actually had these as viable embryos. Little cow people as viable embryos. Maybe there won't be any men. Maybe there won't be any women. May have just be a bunch of cow people. That's Ramona laughing in the other room. If you can hear her, she's cracking up in the other room for some reason. Little cow people. Now, tonight's guest may be able to shed a little light on the following story, which blew me away, literally. I'm a ham operator. You all know that. And ham operators operate in the shortwave spectrum, and from time to time, we have great solar disturbances which come along and, boom, yank the rug out from under you, so to speak, propagation-wise, and all of a sudden the people you could hear and you were talking to, suddenly you can't hear and you can't talk to them anymore because it's all just going straight through the now thinned ionosphere and flying out to space or being absorbed. The following comes from a NASA site, actually. September 12, 2003, on August 24, 1998, there was an explosion on the sun as powerful as 100 million hydrogen bombs. Earth-orbiting satellites registered a surge of X-rays. Minutes later, they were pelted by fast-moving solar protons. Our planet's magnetic field recoiled from the onslaught, and ham radio operators experienced a strong shortwave blackout. None of these things made headlines. The explosion was an X-class solar flare. I mentioned it back then on the air. Anyway, during years around solar maximum, such as 98, flares like that are fairly commonplace. They happen every few days or even weeks. The August 24th event was powerful yet typical. A few days later, no surprise, another blast wave swept past Earth. Satellites registered a surge of X-rays and gamma rays. Hams experienced yet another blackout. It seemed like another X-class solar flare, except for one thing. This flare didn't come from our sun. It came, instead, from outer space. Now, the source of the blast was SGR 1900 plus 14. That would be, get this, folks, a neutron star about 45,000 light-years away. It was the strongest burst of cosmic X-rays and gamma rays we've ever recorded. That's a quote from NASA astronomer Pete Woods. Now, SGR, let me see, what is it? SGR 1900 plus 14 is a special kind of neutron star called a magnetar. Magnetars have the strongest magnetic fields in the universe. A million billion, 10 to the 15th power gauze, said he. For comparison, the magnetic field of the sun is less than 10 gauze in most places, or about 1,000 gauze, perhaps, near a sunspot, but absolutely nowhere near the kind of power that came flying at us from deep space, literally 45,000 light years away. Now, that's 45,000 years at the speed of light, and it overwhelmed anything our sun throws at us. That's something you got to think a little bit about. The wonders of our universe. All right, we'll break here, do a couple more things, then we'll open up lines and take some open line calls until we get to Mr. McCanny at the top of the hour. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories hoard, and they use them to help us to find.
Take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Certainly is. Top of the evening or morning to you, whatever it is, wherever you are. Great to be here. By the way, weekends are absolutely perfect for me because, as you know, I had a very bad back. What took me out last time around. My back is much better. I exercise. I've lost 50. That's 50 pounds. Called the Art Bell Miracle. Don't eat as much diet. Everybody asks, well, how'd you do that? Just don't eat as much, that's all. It worked. 50 big ones. Anyway, we'll be right back. By the way, of course, I would like to thank George and Premier Radio Networks for making all of this possible. I mean, really, for making it all possible. Here's a really interesting article from the New Scientist, and of course, I never read you that much of these, but I thought you should at least hear this. A giant star has actually, by astronomers, been caught in the act of swallowing three planets, one after the other, with each, in quotes, meal, accompanied by a massive eruption. It's like eating three burgers. It's been suggested in the past that the stars might engulf planets in this way, but we believe we have actually caught this action for the first time, says Alan Redder of the University of Sydney, Australia. The star known as V838 is about 20,000 light years from Earth. In January of 2002, it temporarily became the brightest star in the Milky Way. Wow, 600,000 times more luminous than our sun. At the time, astronomers struggled to explain why. What could that explosion have been? Now we know. Redder and his colleagues believe their new analysis of light emissions from the star indicates that it was a red giant that expanded and successfully swallowed three relatively massive planets in quick succession. This time between the first and last engulfment was only about 2 months. So each meal followed, accompanied by a massive eruption, sort of a stellar digestive moment. And then there's one more thing that I should read you. I don't know what sort of validity this has. There are many people, many scientists and physicists who believe that one day we'll get a polar reversal. This is from a website called NASCA, the True Voice of Inquiry. NASCA, the National Association for Scientific and Cultural Appreciation. Get this. Scientists believe the Earth's magnetic poles are about to reverse themselves, an event that would undoubtedly plunge the world into turmoil, some say complete catastrophe. The report in the Sunday Times of London, 12 January 2003, so you know, says that research carried out by Niels Olsen of the Center for Planetary Science in Denmark warns of vast changes now occurring deep in the Earth's core. It is here that our mysterious magnetic field is thought to be controlled from. Swirling vortices of molten matter affect the level of magnetic field above the surface of the Earth once in a while. These vortices become so turbulent they trigger a complete reversal in the magnetic field. On average, this occurring just about every 750,000 years, scientists say the next such reversal is now long overdue. When it comes to the consequences of such an event, we have a little idea, of course, what to expect. The last reversal over 750,000 years ago left no eyewitnesses, no accounts, so we can only speculate about what might have happened back then. However, certain consequences are beyond doubt. All electrically operated equipment would find it difficult to function. Vast storms would bring spectacular, if highly terrifying, displays of thunder and lightning. Seismic and volcanic activity would increase dramatically. One of the greatest fears, however, is that during a polar reversal, the strength of the Earth's magnetic field would fail to such an extent that it would suddenly allow harmful solar rays to penetrate to the surface. This would have a profound effect on all living matter. That would be us. While the Earth's atmosphere might shield out some of the harmful radiation, the consequences of a diminished magnetic field are very grave indeed. Unprotected from the sun's radiation, crops would fail, animals would die, humans fall prone to deadly cancers. So that'd be on the lighter side of this, if the magnetic poles were to reverse. Okay. Why don't we jump into some unscreened telephone action through the top of the hour and our guest. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Good evening, Art.
And good evening to you. Where are you, pray tell?
I'm in Sparks, Nevada.
Sparks, up north. Okay.
Yes.
Excellent.
And welcome back.
Thank you.
I have a question to ask you.
All right.
If possible.
Sure.
George Norrie had a physicist on the program the other night.
Uh-huh.
Plus, I don't remember the gentleman's name that was with him, but they talked about Jupiter. And NASA has apparently sent a plutonium object
yes.
into space, knowing adverse tragic effects could cause Jupiter to be turned into another sun.
Yes, a la 2010.
Yes.
Now, do you remember the movie 2010?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, became a sun.
And plus there could be other tragic effects, not just this turning into a sun, but if the plutonium were to turn into a solid mass, then this mass could possibly work its way back to Earth and, I guess, fall down upon the Earth, causing all kinds of havoc. And I'll get off the air if you can answer any of those questions for me.
I'll do it again. Thank you very much. Actually, tonight's guest will shed, I'm sure, some light on that. My initial pass or guess would be, unless the spacecraft with the plutonium on board were to set off a chain reaction, which is, I'm sure, what fear is, you know, a chain nuclear-type reaction, that would envelop the entire planet, which is now on the edge of becoming a sun, and suddenly cause it to erupt into a sun a la 2010. Well, probably not. I mean, the amount of plutonium we're going to crash into Jupiter is not really that significant. Unless, you know, unless Jupiter's right there on the edge and it's about to become a sun, In which case, probably any sort of event like something crashing into it or whatever all else could also cause the same thing. Wouldn't it be weird to look up in the sky and see two suns? There are certainly systems that have two or even three suns that would be visible from the surface of the planet. Now, talk about a weather change. Ha ha, that'd do it. Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Hello there.
Hi. This is Lisa from Norwalk, California.
Hey, Lisa.
I have missed you. You've made my whole weekend.
It's really cool to be here. You know, radio is something that it gets into your blood like a disease. And,
oh,
you know,
prayed that you'd come back.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Anyway, what's up?
I wanted to know, when you had your old show and you had a website, and I loved your website, it was so interesting, and George is okay, but I wanted to know, are you going to have another website?
Well, no. I mean, I'm part of Coast to Coast AM, which has its own official website now. Now, I have, as I mentioned a little while ago, if you go up and check it out, you'll see Art's webcam up there now.
Yeah, I see it.
And you'll also see the Fast Blast, which will enable you to, you know, say weird things to me.
I can't find that on my computer.
Oh, no, it's there. It's right on the front page. You just got to look harder.
Okay.
It's right on the front page. So you'll see a picture of me or whatever I choose to put up there. And then, and by the way, it's kind of cool because if I get a really good picture, you know, half the time when I have a guest on, they suddenly drop a really incredible photograph on me.
Uh-huh.
And since we can't have Lex working 7 days, 24 hours, this little camera site that I put up there will enable me to, boom, put a picture up there just like that. So if I get one suddenly of something really cool, I can get it up there.
Well, that looks pretty handsome, what I'm looking at right
now. See, there you go.
All right. Hoping you did. I love your bumper music. I love your music, your style, and everything about you, Art.
Well, you're a sweetheart. Thank you.
Well, you've made my weekend.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll let you.
Take care. Yeah, so a couple little modifications up there. I think that the Fast Blast is particularly helpful because I don't think of all good questions, and a lot of you during the course of the event of a guest being here have the opportunity to blast one forth. And you're on the air, Coast to Coast AM, on the international line with Art Bell. Hi.
Hello. Yes, it's Jeff calling from the UK.
The United Kingdom.
Yes, nice speaking with you again.
How's everything on the other side?
Well, the sun's gone up now, so it's not too bad.
Mm-hmm, good.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you'd heard about the sort of progress that's been made with RF tagging. That's like the replacement to barcodes.
I had heard, yeah, you know what? I just recently heard that there's this new thing, folks, instead of barcodes, which we get now on products in stores that can be read, and then, of course, there's a magnetic thing so that if you walk out of the store and it hasn't been swiped, they get you, right? So now there's this new RF tagging thing this gentleman is talking about that's a virtual little teeny-weeny RF transmitter, so it would potentially allow stores to track what you have purchased even past getting out in the parking lot. Hell, they'd probably follow you home. Yeah, you mean that, right?
That's the one.
Yeah, I just heard about it myself.
Yeah, they're taking a bit of a sinister twist. I mean, Gillette products are having them built in. They're almost like micro dots on the products now. They're so small. They're active throughout the lifetime of the product. And they're not just like a normal product would be a barcode, which would be the same throughout the whole range. You know, each item, not individual item, but each, like, the range of the thing would have the same number. Here, every single individual item has a different number.
We really live in a big brother world now, don't we?
Yeah, in the UK, they've even had a situation where it's a bit of a stink because people have been photographed while taking the things off the shelf, just normal purchases. They've been claiming it's an anti-shoplifting measure, but these are completely innocent people being put on videotape.
And what about after they get home?
Well, yeah, you can imagine you go anywhere where there's one of these scanners, and you've got your whole history.
Wait a minute, better not put that in the bathroom. Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Now, he's right. I just heard about the RF tagging thing. It is new, and that's kind of worrisome. If misused, that's always the hitch and the gitch with technology, isn't it? There is a powerful new technology, and it can be used for good or evil, right? That's most technology, and most new powerful technology can be used for good or evil. East of the Rockies, you're on the air, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Hi.
Hello, Art. My name is Caleb. I'm calling from Birmingham, Alabama. I'm listening to you on 960 WRC, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of a little nervous.
Are you? Well,
yeah.
Relax. Your telephone line, though, is kind of bad. It's crackling and crunching.
Oh,
anyway, Birmingham. Okay, well, welcome. What's up?
Well, I've talked to you 2 years ago about three or four times, but I just wanted to, actually, I called to thank you, about last March, a Friday night last March.
Yeah.
You had a guest on talking about reincarnation or something.
Oh, yes.
And, I remember I was laying in bed, I was drifting off to sleep, and you had a bumper music, and I found out it was a Highwayman.
Uh-huh.
And well, the next morning I was talking to my dad about it, talking about your show and everything, and he told me what the song was. I just couldn't get out of my head. I remember waking up in the middle of the night, you know, just writing down little notes, you know, little lyrics of the song.
When I first heard that song, it was like a haunting had descended on me. I'm not kidding you. Like a haunting, almost like a haunting. Music does that to you, of course. It haunts you. And that's what that song did to me. And so the other day when I heard that Johnny Cash had unexpectedly passed away, I understand he was ill, but man, that really, really hit me hard. The Ritter death, and then I was up very late, and then within hours, of course, the death of Johnny Cash. And I don't know, I'm not exactly what you would call a monstrous country music fan. But for some reason, the death of Johnny Cash almost hit me like Lennon's death.
Yeah, but I just wanted to see. I've grown up, you know, in the South. I've always been Southern Brown Country. I've never really liked country myself. But, I mean, you playing that song that night turned me on to Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson. But I'm one of his huge fans, and I just wanted to thank you for that. And
all right, well, listen, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for calling, and you're dead right. That's a haunting song in more ways than one. It's obviously about reincarnation. One of these nights I'll slam it in and we'll play it. It's a haunting song. And the memory of Johnny Cash is a haunting memory, isn't it? That really did hit me hard. I said, what? No, it can't be. And I guess that's when you know you're beginning to age a little bit yourself, because some of the people that you looked up to when you were a child and who were then adults doing what they do, and Johnny did it so well, are beginning to go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Hi.
All right, this is Max here from the high desert in the great Canadian Southwest.
Hello, Max.
All right, it's great to hear you again.
Thank you.
It's great to be hearing Ramona laughing in the background once again.
Well, you know, she really can't help herself. We have a pretty good wall that separates us, but if I say something that really hits her, she gets going and it comes right through.
Although I do remember the time that one, I believe it was at Christmas, that she was on for a half an hour.
That's right.
And she lit into one guy, and I still remember that to this day.
Yeah. Oh, you want to watch out for this woman.
Oh, yeah. But actually, reason why I called...
There's a lot of Paglini in this woman. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. So we'd love to have her back on the air once again eventually, you know.
I'd love to see her get on the air. I have to force her on the air. We do a little show on weekends, which we're going to change around now, here in Pahrump, Nevada, and she does that program with me, and we have a blast. Absolute blast.
Speaking of your radio station, you don't stream.
No, we don't stream. Well, you know, there's a good reason for that. And I'm glad you asked the question, because I can answer this for everybody. Do you know... And I don't have the exact figures with me, but you play music like for our audience here in Pahrump, right? And we pay BMI and ASCAP and whoever that other one is. You know, we pay for that. But if you stream, then you have to pay like 200 or 300% more. It's incredible. And so that stops the streaming. Believe me, it stops the call. That's why so many stations stop their streaming, because of those charges.
Okay.
So that's why.
Excellent. Actually, the reason why I called originally was because, you know, we're sitting here and I'm listening to the news, and I keep hearing the president and all the rest of this going back and forth about the war in Iraq. Oh, there's weapons of mass destruction. There's no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is with the Al-Qaeda. Now he's not with them. You know, we keep seeing this flip-flop going back and forth. You know,
I believe the administration itself the other day admitted that Iraq, to the best of their knowledge, had nothing to do with 9/11, right?
Well, exactly. So exactly why is the United States in it?
I don't know.
You know?
I mean, I don't know. I asked the same question before the war. I said, I don't know why we're going to war, and I still don't know why we went to war. I honestly don't.
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but it's almost like America's like becoming a terrorist nation. Well, the government, I should say, not the people, but the government.
Well,
in a matter of speaking,
you know, from the perspective perhaps of somebody in Iraq, that might be true. I'm sure I don't look at it that way. However, I really do question our motivation. It seems to me the only reason that you risk the life of your citizens, your young men and women, is if your nation is in prime danger, you know. If somebody's threatening you, somebody has attacked you, and you can't pin 911 on them, so that one doesn't work. And it doesn't look like they had weapons of mass destruction. We haven't found them yet anyway. And even if they do, they weren't poised to use them on us. And so, you know, I'm not clear about why we did it. There wasn't enough of an immediate threat to toss American lives into the pot.
Well, you know, I'm starting to see this, and I hate to say this, but George Bush Jr. is starting to look a little more and more like Hitler.
Oh, well, see, now that goes too far for me.
Well, you know, you got to understand, in some points of views, like his motives of... We're not talking like Hitler of the war. We're talking like pre-Hitler of the war.
Hmm.
You know?
All right. Well, listen, anyway, I got to go because this hour is ending. Thank you very much for the call. I wouldn't go that far, certainly. But I do question... Now, our men and women, they did a wonderful job. Our military does what it's told to do, and they do it effectively, fast, and with very minimal casualties. But there are still casualties. And before you subject the men and women of this country to... the ultimate price they pay, you have pretty good reason. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
West of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It really, really is cool to be back here. It really is cool. Hi, everybody. It is a Saturday night and Sunday morning in some places, and it's just plain great to be here. Coming up in a moment, Professor James McCanny, M.S., who is a physicist who has spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system, our solar system, is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. This should be interesting, the effect of the sun on the Earth. McCanny was a faculty member of the Physics and Mathematics Department of Cornell University, Ithaca, New York. He has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics for the layman That would be the studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Labs and American Geophysical Union. It really should be very, very interesting. We will ask about the infamous Planet X, which was supposed to have been here, right? It didn't show up. And several other things. We'll ask about Tesla. We'll ask about the nature of the sun, how it affects the Earth, how it affects our weather. All of those things that I've been curious about all my life, almost the how high is the sky daddy kind of thing. Anyway, we'll be right back with James in a moment. All right. Now comes James McKenney, and let's find out where he is. James, where are you located?
Earth. I'm in Minnesota.
Minnesota, huh? All right. Well, you were not affected or didn't feel the effects, I take it, of Hurricane Isabel there.
No, we missed that one.
I see. Okay. Well, so whose fault was it?
The hurricane?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't really expect you to answer that. We are going to discuss, though, weather, aren't we? So
yes.
Why don't we begin by having you give us an overview of your research. In other words, a traditional weather theory and then comparing it to what you believe to be true, so that we can get an idea of where you're coming from. And then ask questions.
Well, traditional weather theory for the main controllers of our Earth system, one is that they claim that solar light comes down to the Earth's surface and then somehow magically comes up and drives the jet streams. And my concept is that the jet streams are actually electrical bands of ions and electrons in the upper atmosphere.
Really?
Powered by our outer magnetic field. In fact, we have an electron belt that goes around the equator and it moves westward.
Huh.
That's what powers the hurricanes. And we have ion belts, which are in the northern and southern latitudes, which move easterly.
Well, wait a minute, though. If the jet stream were powered by the Earth's magnetic field, that's what you said, right?
It's part of it.
Okay, well then, the jet stream is constantly like a snake moving. I mean, it's all curling and moving and dips down into the southwest U.S. and way back up north again. It's all over the place. It's
right.
Not at all consistent. Why?
Well, the western flowing electron stream is very consistent. It's the northern and southerly one, which are dealing with all kinds of other situations like low fronts and high fronts and many things mixed in there. In fact, they weave around the low and high fronts.
Well, you make a good point. The jet stream does go west to east. It just moves in a north-south way in a sort of wiggly way, right?
Yes, it's like a snake, exactly.
Okay.
And then the other part of it is that when you look at weather systems and you do a very simple thing that physicists are taught to do when they're a freshman, you do an energy calculation. Is there enough energy to do what you're observing? And the simple answer is, when you look at big storms like hurricanes and tornadoes, the amount of energy in the storm that is naturally forming, there's not enough energy locally anywhere near it in the atmosphere to form those storms, so you have to look elsewhere. So ultimately, I looked to the electrical nature of the solar system and found that Earth has many electrical batteries around it.
Well, you're not the first person to suggest that there's not enough energy. Richard C. Hoagland, that I've interviewed many, many, many times, I'm sure you know him.
Sure.
Has postulated that if you look at about 19.5 degrees, any planet, there's a very active area at about 19.5 degrees, and there's not enough energy on those planets to account for that. And I'm not sure that it mixes in with what you're saying, but you're not the first person to say there is simply not enough energy measurable to account for what we see happening.
Great, great. And that's the first thing you have to do. And if there's not enough energy, you have to locate the energy because unlike some people believe there's free energy, well, actually, there's no free lunch in the energy world. It's got to come from somewhere.
Maybe before we proceed, you would be an ideal person to answer a question that I would love to have answered.
Sure.
Okay. As you know, I'm a ham operator, so I have an antenna, big, in my case, a monster, right? I built this big monster antenna.
Right.
It's 1,000 feet around. And then I follow that up by putting another 1,000 foot wire. The first one is fed, they're both fed in parallel, and in phase at 100 feet. And then the top antenna goes 1,000 feet all the way around the property, at 75 feet in altitude past its feed point. And then there's another one that goes all the way around at 68 feet directly below it. And then I put in a ground system 1 inch under the ground below all of that. And anyway, the net result is between the ground system and between the antenna leads, if I take them off this protective device I have outside my window, I'm telling you, James, I've got almost 400 volts.
Yes.
Almost 400 volts coming from where?
That's the atmospheric vertical field. That's what Tesla pulled his energy from, and that's what we could be doing with our grid system. But absolutely, you have basically a small collector there, and the vertical electric field is quite large. It's just that we have a very good dielectric material called air, which holds that ultimately, the ionosphere, which we were talking about, up above us at bay in a capacitor. So basically, we're sitting under a tremendous capacitor. And, of course...
So was Tesla right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to quickly get out on a limb with you here. But if Tesla was right, if there is virtual free energy available, if energy can be transferred virtually through the air... Two things he said, among others. Then, why the hell aren't we doing it? I mean, the government ran in and grabbed everything Tesla had when he passed on and took it away. And if there really was a way to do this, why aren't we doing it?
Because you can't make money on free energy. That's pretty much it, as far as I understand.
Wouldn't they somehow be, even if they wouldn't give it to the average person because they wouldn't have to pay the electric bill anymore, wouldn't the government in some application be using it, or maybe they are?
Well, now, there again, that's what I think happened on our little northeast power outage up there. There was a base west of Ottawa, about 30 miles, that was doing a little Tesla experiment that day, and they...
What?
When they drilled through to the atmosphere...
Back up. There was a little base up there doing a Tesla experiment. Would you care to elaborate, please? What do you mean?
It's called Kanata, Canada, and there's an underground base, actually a U.S. joint military base with the British.
Yes.
It's one of the secret underground bases, but basically the low humming noise that everybody heard over the Northeast that day was the Tesla coil drumming up the atmosphere, and basically what it does...
I remember those reports.
Absolutely.
How do you know this is true?
Well, my little brain was working overtime, and of course, I don't know if you knew it, Art, but I did a show with George Norrie that night. I was the first person on, and then again the next Monday night.
Oh.
The first night, we didn't know what was going on. We were eliminating the solar flare theory. We were eliminating the tree falling over the light pole theory and many other things. And then it wasn't until next days until it actually came out that we were narrowing in on where they actually had the tower up. And it was up in that region. But when they finally tunneled through the atmosphere electrically... and hit the ionosphere.
Do you know how they're doing that?
Oh, yeah.
And you said tunnel through the atmosphere. What are they doing specifically?
Well, it works like this. A Tesla coil is an amplifier, and it's also like a transformer.
Mm-hmm.
And it through the center of it is a long metal rod. And what happens is you have a spark or some kind of trigger, basically, and they were running this probably around 30 hertz. 30 cycles per second,
mm-hmm.
and basically that metal rod sticking up in the air is going between, let's say, 100,000 volts plus and 100,000 volts minus, alternating every about 30 times a second, let's say. That's the whoomp, 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 whoomp that they hear.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it flips the dipoles of the atoms of the molecules in the atmosphere. and it flips them up and down and up and down in unison, because typically the dielectric in the air is due to the fact that all of these molecules are randomly oriented. Mm-hmm. And so when you go plus, minus, it starts orienting all of these all the way up, straight up in a vertical line above the tower. And it takes a tremendous amount of power to do this. As you, being a radio operator, you would imagine this would take a lot of power to synchronize the motion of all those molecules all the way up to the ionosphere. It's about 80 to 100 miles.
I should say, I mean, this is some incredible allegation you're making. You're suggesting a Tesla-like experiment caused the entire Northeast power outage, and that this was going on in Canada, joint U.S.-Canadian project. Are you really sure of what you're saying?
Yes.
You really want to say that, huh?
Yes.
And
when they finally drilled through electrically, what we're talking about here, the power that came down was so much more than they ever imagined, and they had no way to control it. And about 1,000 megawatts of power came down, not through the lines, but around the lines in about a 10-second period. In other words, enough power to power the entire Northeast grid system for a day.
Good Lord, hit it all at once. And, of course, at that point, things begin to trip, breakers go,
right.
Plants would go down instantly. In other words, what happened?
A tremendous, tremendous power surge. And that's the thing that nobody is talking about in the analysis, is where did the power come from?
Well, you just told us. But, I mean, that's such an incredible allegation to make that you were, I mean, did somebody slip this under your door? Do you know this to be true from multiple sources? This, how?
Well, what it's like, you enter a crime scene and the cat with the feather in its mouth just ate the canary. And you look at the evidence and you say, what happened here? First of all, you have to determine where 1,000 megawatts of power came from.
Right.
And it just wasn't floating around the grid system for...
All right, what is your source of information regarding 1,000 megawatts of power being suddenly in the vicinity of the lines?
That was, a lot of this information came out, like a lot of these stories, came out very early in the announcements. And the fact that that day, the people operating the grid and the power station saw a tremendous amount of...
They saw a
lot of power moving up into Canada.
Uh-huh.
And this was the power that it took to power up the Tesla coil. They were using excess power from the Canadian grid, and when they couldn't get enough there, they needed more.
Okay, so in other words, we were not seeing the result of that experiment, but rather the need for power.
Well, there were two aspects. First, it takes a lot of power to drive that Tesla coil
right. To
break through the atmosphere. So those were the transients moving north all afternoon.
Yes.
And I mean, it took probably 45 minutes to an hour to 2 hours possibly of this alternating to actually drill through the atmosphere.
Once they got through,
they had no control electronics to control the surge that came down. They drained the ionosphere down the grid system it came.
So they hooked up the ionosphere directly to the power grid, if only for a moment, and
right.
Poof.
You have to account for the energy, once again, just like our weather system.
Well, may I ask you this? Since you seem to know so much about what they were doing, what was their stated goal? In other words, what were they trying to do when they shut down the Northeast?
Well, there's two ideas. One is that they didn't know what they were doing, and they did it out of ignorance. And the other is that they did it on purpose to then make all the claims that we have a deficient power grid system and we have to soak the public for all this money. So there's two ways of looking at it, and I myself, that's more of a political issue, so I can't really determine why someone would do that, but be that as it may.
But I mean, that you don't. Are you stating you believe that was their intent? That was their motive?
They were trying to figure out if this, how to work. In fact, that's what you started by saying. Wouldn't our government, for their own purposes,
I did say that, yeah,
determine if this was viable and use it? And I believe that's what they were doing at the time. So,
well, again, let me one last time come back to the how you know all this part. I mean, because it's so incredible. Okay, fine. All those megawatts, but still, how do you put that together into there's a base there, that's what they were doing, and I know that to be true? Do you have multiple sources? How did this come to you, please?
Well, what we started to look for, I have kind of feelers I put out.
Yes.
And what I was looking for was some kind of a base at that location up there near Ottawa. And it turns out that there is an Area 51 type of base at a place called Kanata, just west of Ottawa.
See, I didn't know that.
And so that was the...
But you know, how do you pin it on them?
Well, it's... First of all, the surge... There again, you look at the initial information that came out. It came from Ottawa, and it came from that area. And they pretty much fried one of the nuclear reactors up there, my understanding. It was smoking. So they got a pretty heavy surge there. By the time it got down to our 9 nuclear reactors on the northeast coast of the United States, the surge had dissipated all over the northeastern grid system. So, I mean, it had moved all over the place, and very luckily, because if that surge current came down around the wires and into those reactors, it would go wherever it very well liked to go.
Well, you know what? This could all be true, but I would find it hard to believe that they would do this to screw up the Northeast for whatever political reason they might have. I don't see that as a... I don't myself either,
but there are people who
believe that. Yeah, much easier for me to believe that they were doing some sort of Tesla experiment and they had a big oops.
Big oops, yeah. And there is, remind you of the one shuttle experiment, which... I was familiar with the guys down in San Diego.
You're talking about the tether, I bet,
our
right?
Famous tether experiment, yes, where they let the tether out. And I had mentioned to these scientists that if you do that, you're going to be tapping into in a local electric battery up there. And their idea was that it would just drag through the Earth's magnetic field, which was very weak and caused this very weak current. And they were hoping to get 12 volts out of it. To power some computers.
Does anybody, by the way, know, of course, it was so powerful, it blew the tether apart. Does anybody know, actually, what kind of voltage and current they were able to measure just at the instant of the explosion?
Well, it took part of one of the doors off of the shuttle. So, yeah, we're talking, it took all the electronics out. They had one computer that was failing that brought them back in.
Otherwise, they'd have been in big trouble, huh?
Yeah, it blew everything out, yeah. So,
this is some world we live in. All right, James, hold on. James McCanney is my guest. Anybody else know about that base up there in Canada? Oh, my. Whatever I expected to begin here at the beginning of this interview, it wasn't that. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
call in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It certainly is, and I want to remind everybody, you can go up to the website, coasttocoastam.com, and you'll find a new Fast Blast facility there. And you can fast blast me a question for our guest, James McCanny, who's pretty far out on a limb right now with a secret base up in Canada causing the Northeast blackout. Extremely interesting stuff, and I certainly didn't expect that. We'll get right back to it and James in a moment. Whitney in Sioux Falls, South Dakota says, hey, that's why all those cars shut down around Detroit, right? Before the grid went down? Heard people talking about it on national TV. Couldn't figure out why new cars had their radios and engines just quit. Did you hear those reports, James?
Yes.
You did?
Yes. And once again, there were security systems in cars going off. Radios went out. Of course, cell phones were affected because the backup power typically in the cells, the cell transmitters, go out very quickly.
Mm.
Most are powered off the grid or have a small battery backup. But, there were many, many indicators that the power didn't just come down the wires.
Well, in order, for example, I mean, a car's engine can be stopped. They have electromagnetic pulse things that literally can stop an engine as you're going down the road.
That
was considered for use in police work. So that kind of energy, it is possible to produce it, but that kind of energy coming from the ionospheric level, as a result of some experiment, the amount of energy that would have descended on surface Earth would have been incredible.
Well, they had the spikes also measured on HARP. The antenna out in Alaska showed the residue of that pulse all the way over in Alaska.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So HARP was busy measuring while the other side was producing the energy. There was a lot of microwave activity and things like that. One of the things I did right away was I checked the satellites for atmospheric electricity, and there was none. The closest atmospheric electricity that day was in Kentucky, so way out of the picture.
Huh. I have seen in the valley where I live here, Little Prump Valley, and of course we live close to Area 51 here, but I have seen an electromagnetic blanket descend on this valley that didn't let anything through, and we proved it. I mean, it shut down. I've got a KU band uplink here that does the program, you know, sends a program to satellite and then on to New York and all over the world. But baby, it shut down. I could go in there and watch the EB level, and I watched it decline to the point where after the satellite actually lost lock, and boom, it was gone. And then I've got microwave internet that I receive here, James. It stopped, and the graphs all coincided. It all happened at the same time. It's like some kind of electromagnetic blanket descended on this valley, and nothing worked. Nothing. I've seen that happen, and I wonder if that's somebody toying around with who knows what. Tesla related? I would have no way of knowing, but I've seen that happen.
Well, and usually it's an adjustment of the ionosphere, because a lot of those, especially the satellite frequencies, especially the uplinks, I believe are higher frequency than the downlinks.
Well, they're close. 11 to 14 gigahertz in that range. You know,
yeah,
very
but they
high.
They go through all just about anything.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
And as far as atmospheric is concerned, that's why they chose them.
Like a knife, yes.
But to be completely shut down, you're talking a very, unusual atmospheric condition.
Well, it certainly wouldn't surprise me that our military or the Canadian military or both might be experimenting with technology capable of that. I mean, that would be one hell of a weapon if you could virtually shut down everything electrical and digital that an enemy would have. That would be a pretty significant advantage, wouldn't it?
Right, right. If they were a modern army. In fact, that's actually seen as one of the vulnerabilities of the United States, is we're so dependent on that that if somebody were privy to that, and even our satellites, the Chinese, in fact, I think we're talking about this, having dumb satellites which simply went up, strapped themselves onto one of our satellites and blew up.
The Russians too have made a lot of strange claims. For example, and maybe you have some background on this, the Russians claimed that when they were having these awful fires in Southeast Asia, the Russians made the claim that they could create a cyclone.
Right.
And that the cyclone would put the fires out. And the Russians said, we will do that one time as a demonstration, free of charge. But the next time it will cost you money. Would you like us to do it? And I think the Indonesians said, no, thank you. But the Russians made that claim in that way. Would you like us to do it? Do you think such technology might conceivably exist?
Actually, yes. And the situation is just as with the situation in the Northeast, if you can find a way to basically provide a path to the ionosphere, you can drain the energy. And one of the other parts of all my theoretical work regarding weather is that this is electrically driven. The tornadoes, cyclones, hurricanes are, in fact, driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere.
Uh-huh.
Sprites and elves and these other electrical phenomena that you see above clouds is actually just part of the electrical current powering these systems.
They haven't known about sprites too long. These are these vertical, sort of really weird, like lightning bolts that go right up through the ionosphere, and they're seen by spacecraft, right?
Right. Yeah, they're very powerful. They're sometimes have X-rays in them.
Well, all right, let's test your theory for a second. If the Earth's weather only had the light of good old soul to drive its weather or to provide the energy, which is, of course, not your theory, but rather traditional theory, then what do you think our weather would be like? If we only had the power of the sun, whatever that happens to be, to drive our weather, what would it be like as opposed to what we have?
Well, if we only had light from the sun,
yes.
And of course what I say is there's a tremendous electrical component coming off the sun, but if we only had visible light, we would have tremendously bland weather. We wouldn't have the jet streams. We wouldn't have, in fact, cloud formation would be difficult because clouds are actually forming due to the electric field. It's like the old Wilson cloud chamber where you would take and have a mist of water basically in a chamber, and as the charged particles, high energy particles came through, then you'd put this in a magnetic field and the charged particles would actually trace through the water vapor.
Mm-hmm.
And you could measure their radii circulation through this. But you had to put a vertical electric field on that water to form the cloud. And so it's my contention we wouldn't even have clouds. We wouldn't have cumulonimbus clouds. And these are the electrical fingers that point upwards that actually begin to attach to the ionosphere, just like the Tesla experiment, but naturally. And they are the points where the electricity does come down naturally and form the lightning storms that we see on the leading edge of a storm. And also, for example, here's what causes a hurricane. Over the ocean, as the storm clouds roll off of Africa, moving westward, westerly,
right.
Those clouds attach to the electrons in the westward-moving electron belt, which is up in the ionosphere. And so there are electrons up there, and they're trying to get down to Earth. They're the primary movers in any electrical current.
Actually, the clouds that turn into the hurricanes move off the African coast to the
To the west.
You're right, to the west. That's
to the
right,
west. They're moving along with that westerly moving ion belt.
Correct, yes.
And then as they get out over the ocean now, the current no longer has the ground to attach to, so what happens is the ionized air that's around the ocean becomes, it starts to move in, and it's sucked up the central column, much like a vacuum cleaner. And I always contend that you have a low-pressure cell, of course, at the center eye region of a hurricane.
Right.
Well, with air moving in there at about 100 miles an hour, how do you keep that low-pressure cell? There has to be an energy source that keeps that low-pressure cell a low-pressure cell. And so at any rate, what happens is you literally have the ions being sucked up into the column, and as they rotate upwards, or as they move upwards, they rotate just the opposite of water going down a drain. This is going up the drain, so to speak. And as the water-rich air comes up the column and spinning, as it gets up high in the atmosphere, it condenses and then it moves out.
Okay, well, all of this might be a little difficult for some people, but the bottom line here would be that if it's electrically driven, which is what you're suggesting, right?
Right.
Perhaps technology like Tesla technology would be ideal for controlling the weather.
That's right, and we probably wouldn't want to control all the weather, but the big storms, like, for example, Isabel is a great example of what I'm talking about, because as it moved across the big ridge that comes south of Andros Island, just off the coast of South Carolina,
yes,
about 300 miles out, as it came across there, that's when the hurricane dumped a lot of water and a lot of energy, and it regained a bit as it came through the deep ocean region between there and landfall in the Carolinas and Virginia.
Right.
And, of course, the traditional meteorology says that, oh, we had an upper level shear wind, and that's what topped off the hurricane.
Huh.
But then, well, gee, that's sure convenient that shear wind went away just as it went back into deep water. But now take the scenario that I want to do, an experiment, and take grounding rods out there with floats and then basically weather balloons tethered down to the grounds. And so basically what you would be doing is you would be draining the electrical energy out of the hurricane before it ever got to land. It would dump its water.
All right, let me see if I've got this right. You would have balloons tethered in the water.
To buoys that then are grounded down.
I'm sorry, balloons that would be in the air that would be tethered to buoys.
Yes.
That would be grounded what? To the ocean or to the ocean floor?
To the ocean floor on that ridge that
to the ocean
runs
floor.
Right down from Andros Island. So the buoys would not be anchored very deeply.
So you would contend then that the storm, as it approached, would be electrically discharged and thusly weakened. And so you have a way of either weakening or turning a hurricane.
Right. The other possibility, which is probably more viable, is to get up above it with a satellite and shine laser beams down through it and ionize that air with laser beams, thusly causing electrical paths that diffuse the hurricane. And so those are a couple methods that you could use. I actually presented
this. How would you imagine that the Russians would technically stand by their claim to be able to create a cyclone? It'd probably be the opposite of what you're talking about.
Right. There you would try to do basically a Tesla type of situation where you create the artificial, so to speak, cloud and then extension up to the atmosphere. So you would pick a cloud that's a nice big one.
Yes.
And you would run your laser beam right up through the middle of it to the ionosphere and cause that electrical current to come down, and there's your cyclone.
Huh. What about traditional weather theories of formulation of storms like that, that the warm water of the South Atlantic and or the South Pacific in the case of typhoons contributes to the building of these storms? It's a factor, I'm sure. It has to be, right?
Well, unfortunately, if you do a energy calculation, and the only thing that goes into the equation of energy is the fact that you can evaporate water off of that. You can't cause the tremendous amount of energy in a hurricane, which is humongous. It's the equivalent, one hurricane is the equivalent of all the atomic bombs on Earth. A storm like Isabel or Fabian that we had moving across the Atlantic after August 27. So those storms harbor tremendous, tremendous amounts of energy. And then you have examples, for example, Hurricane Floyd, 1999, which was followed across the ocean by another hurricane in the exact same path.
Yes, I recall.
And how do you form two hurricanes across the same path? Didn't you just use that energy to create the first one?
Oh, that's a very good point. I've often wondered about that myself. Doesn't the energy essentially get used up as the hurricane passes? And have one pass in exactly the same place was very odd.
Yeah, and just not more than a day later. It wasn't like 2 weeks later. It was a couple of days. But the simple calculation is that the energy of evaporation, and, of course, the ocean is slightly cooler when that hurricane passes, and that's because this air is rushing over it,
right,
sucking off the warmer water,
right,
so it leaves it cooler. But that's not the energy that drives the hurricane. We're talking, you know, as far as energy equation, there's no balance at all, nowhere near the energy to provide that hurricane with the energy it needs to be a hurricane.
Does the fact that the physics involved is as you suggest, and not as traditional meteorologists suggest, account for the lack of accuracy of their predictions? In other words, they've never been able to get science right of weather. Now, I know it's going to irritate the hell out of a lot of people, but I mean, they really haven't. They get it wrong a lot.
Right.
They get a lot of things about it wrong. And of course, if they're operating with physics that's not accurate, that would account for why they get it wrong.
Right. And that's one of the things I use in weather prediction. For example, last spring I did my annual hurricane prediction. I said that on June 27th there was a very minor energy contribution and we had Hurricane Claudette. And I said, there won't be any hurricanes until August 27th. And I said, at that point, the Earth is going to explode. And it did. And then I said, the other date is September 10th. Well, Hurricane Isabel. So all these dates are predictable because...
I didn't know you had said all that. I mean, the audience, I'm sure, will hold your feet to the fire on that. And obviously, you did say it or you wouldn't make that claim. So
Right. Congratulations.
You made those predictions based on what you believe you know about the real physics of what drives our weather.
Right. And you cannot say, well, there's going to be a hurricane right here at latitude, longitude, such and such, but you can say on such and such a date, there's a high probability of tremendous energy flux, and these are the conditions that are ripe for hurricanes and typhoons. And most of the people don't know about all the typhoons in the Pacific this year. We've had a tremendous number. In fact, there's one right now called Marty.
Yeah, we mostly ignore them. I mean, there are people devastated
over there.
Oh, they're incredible. Of course, the traditional theory is the Pacific is a much longer route, so that they form, of course, off Baja or whatever, and then take off across Pacific. They've got a lot of very hot weather and very moist weather and very good conditions for building to gigantic size. And they do, in fact, get up to, 220, 230 miles an hour is not unusual. I've seen it.
Right. So they do have the bigger storms over there, but the one in Korea called Maimea, something like that.
Yes.
Maima or something. I can never pronounce that name. Just recently, had a central low pressure cell of only 27 millibars.
Oh,
now that's hardly
that's
able
hard
to breathe.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah, you can't breathe at that pressure. You know, I mean, talk about having a bad hair day.
Yeah.
But so these are tremendous storms that we've seen here. But
And you're saying we're now in the business of manipulation of these storms. Do you think that Isabel was in any way manipulated?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that. They're at the point where they can actually manipulate yet.
But you've got a scheme. You've got a scheme for manipulation that you just described to us.
Right.
Why not give it a shot? Why not try?
I think so. And also, there's the idea that trailer courts attract tornadoes is really true because it's
electrical. Hold on to that thought. We'll get right back to you. I knew that had to be true. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
The weekday and weekend numbers are different, so you might want to make note of those when we get around to taking calls here. I'm Art Bell, and this is the new weekend slot that I'm proud to be a part of. It's certainly great to be here. Not to forget, we have new features on the website, a webcam up there, which I will not allow to refresh frequently, so I have my privacy, but there will be photos up there of various things. By the way, during the week, too, and some of the stuff I put up there, you'll just have to figure out what it is, be ham radio related or whether, you know, inside or outside. It could be anything on that webcam. All sorts of weird stuff. And then, of course, we have the Fast Blast there as well, which allows you to fire a question in this direction, which I will then receive on a computer screen right next to me. James McCanny is my guest. We're talking about the weather and electrical manipulation of the weather, actually, even Tesla-like manipulation of the weather, and why the weather is doing what it's doing versus traditional meteorology, which thinks one way. And, you know, even the traditional meteorologists these days acknowledge the weather is changing. The storm's becoming more violent, and the weather is getting pretty crazy out there, folks. Even they have noted that. Perhaps James, with his theories, has a different take on why it's happening. No doubt, though, it is happening. We'll ask in a moment. James, the meteorological world has begun to observe, and I think we've all noticed the weather would appear to be in the middle of some sort of profound change. Storms are becoming more frequent, more violent in every way. And with what you believe about what drives our weather systems, why do you believe that is so?
Well, ultimately, the electrical component of the sun, which is locked into the solar wind that passes by us, is very much accelerated from what it normally would be. We did not have a solar maximum, so to speak. The solar energy went up at the year 2000, and it never stopped going up. I remember in about March of 2001, NASA scientists said, well, we're finally over this. The sun should finally start to quiesce and calm down.
Wait a minute. It has. So, I mean, the number of sunspots, for example, has definitely declined.
Right.
However, the amount of radiation passing by Earth does not seem to have declined. And
sure.
It's been at record levels. As a ham radio operator, I can tell you we have been bombarded lately. I mean, really very serious stuff. And people have been noticing aurora at very low latitudes. So, yes, the number of sunspots is down, but not the amount of energy streaming by at this incredible rate, right?
Right. And our magnetic field protects us from that.
Right.
But what I've noticed about the weather predictions and the weather reaction to what the sun is doing is the Earth can stabilize and it can protect us quite well under steady state conditions. But when change occurs, when all of a sudden you get a rapid flux change in the solar wind speed or the density or magnetic field change in the solar wind, those changes are the things that cause effects down on the ionosphere and eventually are driven down to the surface to our weather. And that's why you were saying, why do meteorologists seem to get it right, you know, 8 days in a row, and all of a sudden they say it's going to be sunny tomorrow and a tornado runs you over?
I'm not sure I gave them that good a batting average, but,
But something like that.
Yes.
And that's because they don't include the most important factor, which is the electrical factor driving, literally driving our weather. So you have to understand, too, how they make weather predictions. They say, okay, here's the atmosphere. They measure it all around at data points up in the atmosphere, and they put it in a computer, and they say, okay, given these conditions previously, this is what happened. So they basically extrapolate based on if you had these conditions in a previous situation. And that, by the way, is how they do hurricane prediction and hurricane tracking prediction. They say, okay, most hurricanes that went where Isabel went up here, so that's where we're going to say it's going to go.
For a second, let's talk about stopping hurricanes again, or if not stopping them, then lessening their severity or turning them or whatever. You actually gave us a down-home method of doing it. You said you put a ground on the ocean floor, you run it up to a buoy, and then you run balloons way up. The storm comes along and virtually gets grounded. Now, that's pretty interesting stuff, James. Why haven't you presented this to NOAA? I mean, compared to other methods that people have suggested, you know, seeding clouds and exploding bombs, I mean, yours is a pretty benign suggestion for controlling the wrath of a storm that'll cost billions of dollars. Why not lay this in NOAA's lap and say, here you go, guys, it's benign, it won't cost you much to try it, well, maybe a few bucks, give it a try.
Well, Art, I have.
you have?
Back in the 90s, yes, I presented that to them and the Air Force. And, in fact, with the Air Force, we had a method of taking B-52s up over the flying them up over and through the eye, basically, and dropping another type of tether. Basically, it's a weighted tether.
Right.
Where a metal weight drops out and with somewhat of a balloon type of situation, but the metal carbon fiber tether drops down and literally drops through the hurricane. You just literally blanket the hurricane with these in the same manner.
Well, what are you blanketing? How do you do that from a plane?
Well, you just drop them and drop them. You know, you drop thousands of these things out, and as they unravel, basically you have a balloon with like a spindle and a 6,000-mile cord of carbon fiber, very, very fine carbon fiber, and this just runs out.
Gotcha.
And so basically that provides another current path.
So whichever way you do it, from the sky or down from the ground, you contend it would work and either stop. What do you think it would do if a hurricane ran into a whole field, for example, of these grounded, tethered things? What would it do to the hurricane?
Well, the same thing that it does when it hits land, and I always ask people this question.
Oh.
Do you think the hurricane, when it hits land, hits trees and buildings, and that's what stops it?
Well, that's...
No.
Wait a minute. Traditional thought is that a hurricane gets over land, and it no longer has the energy from the ocean to feed to it.
Right, but if you realize that, for example, we've seen hurricanes on Mars. There are no oceans on Mars. We've literally had hurricanes over land, and I call them himicanes. But meteorologically, they are not classified as a hurricane or any type of storm. But we regularly have, 28, say, millibar pressure over land.
That is true.
Swirling clouds and tornadic activity.
I've seen it. Yep.
They've been in your area, Art, down there.
I've seen it. Yeah, sure.
And so, literally, they do exist over land. But the point is that when you realize that the energy balance equation simply cannot provide the hurricane with that amount of energy, you have to look elsewhere for that energy, and something that's going to form that eye with the sucking up and keeping that low pressure cell down there. How do you keep a low pressure cell anywhere when there's air moving into it at 100 miles an hour?
That's interesting. So what did NOAA say? I mean, how did they greet your suggestions?
Well, it was kind of put on the shelf and not responded to, like a lot of other things I do in my scientific career.
Not responded.
Simply not responded.
You didn't even get a letter back that said, thank you, James McKenney, for your suggestion. NOAA will take it under advisement. Something, nothing, no, huh?
This is kind of like sending it into a black hole. And there's a lot of politics because NOAA is a government agency.
Yeah.
And so you have this backed up by a lot of other, it goes all the way back to, is the solar system electrical? And a lot of mainstream scientists don't believe that.
So then you're suggesting that these high-stream particles that are blasting by the Earth are virtually the majority of the energy that's driving our weather systems.
Absolutely. And
I've
identified 17, not 7, but 17 different batteries that are formed as a result of this, and let me just describe one.
All right.
When the protons and electrons come out in the solar wind, they hit our magnetic field, and the protons go one way, and the electrons go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that causes a battery. You have a separation plus and minus charge.
Yes, sir.
Now imagine when all of a sudden you get a solar flare, and the increased pressure causes our magnetic field to reduce in size. Then an increase in the separation of charge, you've got two factors that increase that battery around Earth, and it's a transverse battery. So now we were holding our own, so to speak. Now all of a sudden the pressure is closer to us, and it's much more intense, the electrical pressure, you might say.
Right.
So that's when you get storm activity. And you can see this. So I look at the sun at SOHO. And by the way, when we had a short conversation before the show about your ham radio operation there in the last few weeks, so I took a close look at the solar conditions.
Oh, let me tell you, brother. It's been brutal. Brutal.
It's interesting that they took the SOHO satellite offline on the 18th and the 17th. There was a number of the instruments were actually shut down. We can't see what
I'm sadly aware of that, I'm afraid. Yeah, they took SOHO offline. I read you a little thing before the show. It was a headline from NASA entitled Solar Flares on Steroids. And if what you're saying is true, and the normal blasts from the sun, or the abnormal ones even, account for our weather with the electrical activity of the protons and everything blasting by Earth, then this article is incredible. Solar Flares on Steroids. This was a blast that should have come from our sun, but didn't, came from, they claim, a neutron star 45,000 light years away, and it was stronger than anything we experienced from our sun, so that would produce all kinds of crazy activity on Earth that nobody could account for from our sun.
Well, there again, I find it hard to believe that something 45,000 light years away affected us. I would look for some situation in our local solar system that caused those, because up until 1998, we didn't even know the sun produced cosmic rays.
So you think they've got that part right, but the source wrong?
Right.
You think it's closer?
I think it's closer.
You think there's no way that a source that many light years away could produce that kind of energy?
Well, it's too phenomenal, as I recall, I'm trying to think if they had a second source, like, say, a microwave measurement or something of that same source at the same time.
Anyway, if that kind of energy hit us and there is an effect, despite the magnetic field being present, there is such a large effect on Earth's weather and so forth, then it accounts for an awful lot of recent activity, doesn't it?
Right. And absolutely, we have been very much affected by stronger weather. I believe it was the World Weather Organization, and I forget the exact name of it, but this past year, and they made a blanket statement, like you say, there has just been a tremendous increase in weather activity, and it's unexplainable in terms of standard meteorological.
The World Meteorological Association,
there,
or something like that.
That is it.
A normally very staid organization that would never lend itself to radical statements just flat came out and said, it's bad and it's going to get worse.
Right.
And so what are they basing that on? Because they're using traditional meteorological knowledge and physics to explain. Well, they can't explain it, but that's what they'd be using versus what you believe to be true, right?
Right. But it's interesting that this past spring in April, someone, and I'm not sure if it was Defense or if it was NASA or who exactly put these satellites up. But it came out as an announcement. Two large, much bigger than SOHO, much more sophisticated satellites, a pair of them, were sent up to monitor. Their sole purpose was to monitor the solar energy in every aspect. And they wanted two of them because they wanted a pair of eyes, so to speak, to when flares came out. That was one of the problems with SOHO, is that when a flare came out, you had one point of view, so you couldn't tell if it was coming at us or going away or whatever. But with the new pair, they would be able to tell this, and much with better instruments, modern instruments, measure the solar conditions. And we have not heard anything out of these two satellites. But they obviously sent them up there because they believe the solar energy is way above normal.
With what you know about what drives our weather and what you believe to be going on in the sun and perhaps other sources, what do you see ahead for us?
Well, weather is hard to predict, and I make certain predictions with reservations, you know, like any weather prediction, but it seems to be going up without bound, and that's what's scary. I mean, that's what is, and of course, these meteorological associations are finally saying.
Yes.
And you see the local weather. Minnesota has more money put into meteorological TV weather than any other state in the union. So it's a very weather knowledgeable state, so to speak. And sometimes the weathermen stand there and they just with a stupid look on their face and they, you know, what's going on here? We don't know, but
yeah, I've seen that look. Yes,
but it's different than say Hawaii, where they say, well, it's 78 and the wind's from the northeast at 12, and that's it.
Yes.
You know, that's the weather report. But definitely, the sun is much more active. And here's the thing that I want to account also is that back when I did all my original theoretical work decades ago, I said that the solar energy is not coming from its core, it's coming from the surface, and it's subject to very rapid changes. And
science has recently confirmed that for you.
Yes, it has. It has. And the Russians did a very interesting experiment in the mid-90s where they scanned across the sun with an X-ray detector. And as they scanned in from the edge, they would subtract off what they knew was coming from the outer regions. And as they scanned and got deeper into the solar atmosphere, the X-rays got cooler, not hotter. Which basically, and they said they even found at a certain level there was a cool core. In other words, there was some kind of a planetary core to the sun. And literally the fusion was up in the atmosphere, which right there confirmed everything I said.
Very near the end of the disk or the edge of the disk.
Right.
All the way around.
Right. And so the solar flaring, the fusion, the solar corona, which is almost relativistic speed electrons whizzing around the sun with no physical means of keeping them there, all of this is related to a very super atom type of state that the sun is in. And this is very volatile. We've seen comets come in, and like back in the 98 when those two comets came in, and I remember you had it posted on your webpage even, that tremendous flare. One of them went through.
You know what? There's no question about it. Comets either doing close passes or impacting with the sun just are spectacular events that cause big events on the sun, don't they?
Yes, and they're not unrelated like some scientists would have you think. They're very related, and so my belief with the sun is that, by the way, the other thing I look at are the number of comets coming in and where they're coming from. In this past year, from about February, and we have just been barraged by comets coming from the south. Hmm. And that has told me that there's an entourage of things coming in, and it tells me that something big possibly may be coming in from the south, carrying all this stuff with it. And we're just seeing the beginnings of this. So,
how big?
To carry the things, like, for example, this comet NEAT, V1, which was that had that tremendous flare, people could see it from the street on the, you know, on walking out of their buildings at the end of the day. They could see this comet next to the sun at sunset. So this was a big, very bright comet.
Indeed so.
So it wasn't a nucleus, a half a mile across, made of ice, causing this. But
All right. Listen, we're at a break point, so hold it right there for a second. I've got a lot of very important things I want to ask you about. Got about another half hour to do that. Then we'll dig into the telephone lines with James McCanny, a physicist who believes that our weather is driven by something very different than most physicists, and he could well be correct.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Phone lines are going wide open at the top of the hour, and we'll take your calls for James McCanny, a physicist who says that they've got it all wrong, that it's really radiation coming from the sun and possibly elsewhere that drives our weather here on Earth. Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask him if he thinks other than the sun and whatever all else, whether planets, other planets, and the motion of other planets also contribute to this electrical activity that drives our weather and more here on Earth. That's what we'll ask in a moment. Once again, James McCanny. James, do you believe that planets also, which of course have their own energy or are being affected in the same way Earth is, that planets themselves, other planets in our system, for example, contribute energy to this whole process?
Absolutely, and that's part of my weather prediction is determining these alignments and which ones are significant.
Huh.
And, for example, all of the planets, let me backtrack just a little bit, and when we were talking about the solar wind of protons and electrons,
yes.
Something I determined a long time ago is that there is an excess current of protons in the solar wind, and this creates a large battery capacitor in the solar system way out beyond Pluto. And part of that capacitor is a returned current sheet, and due to the characteristics of this, I've determined that we, the Earth, pass through that, and so do all the other planets, by the way, when we are in the month of August. So I've termed this the return current sheet of August. That's why we have the peak of the hurricane season in August. That's why we have the peak of the aurora season in August and of the tornado season because of the fact
all
that we're
that energy. All that energy.
Right. And
All right, so getting back to planets, they do play a part in this.
Well, all the planets, just like comets, are discharging the solar capacitor to a degree, very locally, very minimally, but
gotcha.
They are all discharging it. And so electrically, they are connected to the sun and this outer capacitor region. So when the planets align, gravitationally, there's no big deal because we're basically weightless with respect to all the other planets.
Right.
As we move through our, wind through our orbit in outer space. But electrically, when these things align, and that includes our new moon and full moon, when these align, all of a sudden we start getting electrical connections. And one of the big triggering things, and this is what I used for my August 27th prediction, was we had a full moon or a new moon passing. We had Earth and Mars in direct alignment all on the 27th,
that's correct.
And we were right in the middle of that return current sheet of August. And I said, okay, that new moon is going to trigger it.
Yeah.
And that's why I didn't make a big deal about this when I made my predictions, but that's why on the 26th, there was absolutely no hurricane activity anywhere on the planet. And all of a sudden on the 27th, when that new moon passed and
kaboom.
Let the normal solar wind come through,
right.
boom.
Huh. You know, when you look back on mankind's past, this is something that has, in a way, always been known. If you talk to American natives, for example, they will talk to you about the meaning of comets.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that a long time ago. They will talk to you about the meaning of things seen in the sky and the phases of the moon and the sun, and it was sort of all known there and how it related, and it's kind of been forgotten, and now you're remembering it, aren't you, James?
That's right. And the comets, in 99, we had a small comet called Comet Lee come through, and it was in May of that year. I said September 6th is an alignment very unusual between Venus. We then had a new moon also, Earth, and Comet Lee. And this alignment, I said, it's going to be tremendous because Comet Lee was just up and above and behind us, a very small comet.
Mm-hmm.
But it triggered Comet Floyd and four other hurricanes in the Atlantic at one time on September 6th.
Then just sort of staying on this path for a moment with the planets, what do you suppose is going to happen when NASA slams all of this plutonium unto Jupiter? Now, I wanted to ask you about that and get your potential opinion on it.
Well, the situation with Jupiter is that, first of all, it's a small star with its own proton wind. That's one thing Voyager very distinctly saw when it looked down and flew by Jupiter back in the early 80s or whenever that was.
Oh, yes.
And so anyway, Jupiter creates its own capacitor, as does Saturn.
Uh-huh.
And so when Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 came down and hit, basically, the explosions were immense, and it came out in X-rays and everything else. And originally, NASA said, we're not even going to look at it. Those little ice balls are just going to penetrate into the atmosphere, and by the time Jupiter turns around, you're not going to see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians had their instruments trained on it. The amount of X-rays and ultraviolet light reflecting off the moons, this is what they were measuring at Earth.
Right.
The amount of X-ray and ultraviolet light reflecting off the other moons of Jupiter was so intense, they could actually measure it at Earth from the explosions as those comets came down. And what happened is the electrical discharges that between the outer region around Jupiter and the atmosphere is what caused the tremendous explosions.
Is there any possibility at all that something could trigger Jupiter into a chain reaction?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Oh, yes?
Yes. Yes. In fact, Jupiter is literally a small star, produces about twice the amount of energy that arrives at, from the sun. It gives off about twice that energy in the form of infrared light. But literally, if enough energy hit Jupiter, it could trigger it. In fact, actually, Saturn is a better candidate because Saturn is far more active than Jupiter is.
Although we are going to smash into Jupiter.
Right. But that little thing is, I should add, is not, I don't believe, anywhere near enough to do that type of triggering.
Ah, that was my initial assessment, too. Power, but nowhere near enough.
Right. A little local activity there, but certainly is not going to, but we don't know. It's like a match in a gasoline can. We don't know what will trigger those things. If you, a very small spark next to a gasoline can will send it skywards. So we don't really know the type of thing that would cause that type of chain reaction, but my guess is that it wouldn't be enough.
Hope not.
Yeah. Well, we'd have a second little sun in this. We'd get tan at night now.
Yeah.
Beach parties, just think of the revenue. It might be a boon to the tourist industry.
Well, it might. And now also I note on your materials that I got to look at, you also apparently have commented, you actually have a pamphlet entitled Surviving Planet X Passage. Well, there were some strange folks who gave us dates for the passage of Planet X. And, it didn't happen.
Correct.
Basically, it didn't happen. So, you've obviously looked into the Planet X phenomena and, have some opinion about it. Do you have any comment on that or?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there again, when I realized, even as we approached that May 15th date, and I had said all along, because I do my own observing, as an astronomer, amateur astronomer, there was nothing coming in from there. And pictures were coming up on the Internet, and I was looking, and I was, well, I don't know what they're seeing, but I'm not seeing it.
Oh, they were seeing lens flares and all kinds of crap. I looked at some of the pictures, and I didn't see anything other than a lens flare, and they were trying to say it was some kind of body, and it was all being hidden, and it was baloney. Okay. Anyway.
But the bottom line is that, and there was a lot of mixing of information, but basically there appears to be historic validity to the fact that something comes repeatedly into this solar system.
Well, yes.
And we get it. But see, here's my take on it. If you're saying, okay, here is a thing and it's in historical records, when something big comes in, how are you going to say, well, that's the thing I'm talking about? Because we're now learning that there are a lot of big things coming into the solar system that we never knew about before. And so I've actually changed the title of what I talk about, and I call it my search for extra solar system objects, because now we know that things are coming in that are big.
Well, we are constantly learning new things. I mean, even ABC ran a story about the probability of another planet as yet unreally detected that's out there that they can... somehow or another, they can measure the fact that it has to be there.
Right.
So I don't just dismiss all of this out of hand, but is it your view that there is a Planet X coming or has been here in the past?
Well, for example, the 3,600-year time frame that people keep quoting is actually related to the Venus event, which was, what Velikovsky was talking about. And if it became the planet Venus, then it's not out there to come back again. So,
it's true.
That, a lot of people mix stuff together, is what I'm saying, not realizing that they're contradicting themselves in doing so. So, but it does appear from old, the Sumerian, the Egyptian, obviously, when Solon went back and talked to the Egyptians from Greece. They told him, this has happened to us, and it's a major catastrophe. It comes from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hopi Indians from your area talked about that. In fact, I was listening to Robert Ghostwolf one night. You were talking with him. And, of course, being a comet guy, I was listening, and he's talking about the seven levels of Earth change. And,
yes.
And all of a sudden he goes, and, of course, it's the blue comets that caused this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just about
fell
off my chair.
Not just Robert, but I interviewed a bunch of Hopi elders. I mean, these are really, would he help arrange? These are really serious, really serious people. It was a show to suffer through in a way because I had to have a translator.
Mm-hmm.
But it was worth doing, and what they had to say about comets would stand the hair on the back of your neck straight up.
I have a book.
So we as humans knew, James.
Yes.
We knew.
Yes, and this comes down from every culture. I study the Mayans myself. It's one of my personal hobbies, you might say, is archaeological work in Latin America. And all the way from the tip of South America up to just south of the United States, the Mayans and the all have the tradition of Quetzalcoatl in some form or another, which mm-hmm. is the plumed serpent god of the night sky who ravaged the earth. And this is what their culture grew out of. Of course, a lot of my book material is based on everything from historical records to the science that I do, and I weave in the archaeological work. And, of course, the latest book is dealing with Atlantis, you know, in the myths and legends and how it actually makes sense once you realize that Atlantis, my belief is that it didn't go down just in the most recent Earth catastrophe. It probably happened on a previous one.
You know about the city off the coast of Cuba.
Yes, absolutely. How did it get there?
You know, let's flip over. We've talked about controlling storms and how storms are created and why they're created and then discharging the power from storms. But let's talk about the opposite side of the technology for a second and Tesla. In other words, what practical method can you imagine for extracting energy from this, from, what would be the right way to phrase this, from our atmosphere, from our ionosphere, in other words, to harness this energy that we've been talking for 2 hours about now?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's easy to do, actually. And I've just, earlier in the show, explained the method where you use the Tesla coil to alternate the dipoles in the molecules in the atmosphere, and that starts to align them. And it breaks down an electrical path to the ionosphere.
What kind of device do you imagine that might do this?
Well, it's the Tesla coil is a transformer.
Right.
Hooked to an amplifier, and basically the way it works is you have a trigger on a DC power supply. And that trigger snaps, let's say, 30 times a second, just
uh-huh.
like the points on the old type of car.
Yes.
Okay, so you've basically got a very high vertical spike, and that then is amplified hundreds of thousands of times in your transformer. It's a step-up transformer with thousands of coils.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're getting, let's say, 100,000 volts at the top of your coil,
mm-hmm.
and then when it comes back down, it drops down to a negative 100,000 volts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is your pipe that's sticking up in the air 200 feet. And around that, you have basically a collecting tower. Once you've tapped into this, now you've got to deal with the power that starts to come down for free.
All right. Here's my question, James. Why haven't you or somebody who you've been able to engage and believe all of this built something like this to demonstrate it? Or is that a good way to get yourself killed?
Well, yes, it's a good way to get in trouble in this country. Actually, the best place to do this is at the equator, because there you're dealing. See, now, when Tesla did his tower, he did it in, I believe, New Jersey and Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And there you're dealing with the reverse situation where the electrons are coming out of the ground. It's a very inefficient process. And what I've understood now is that the best place to do this would be at the equator, because the electrons are up in the ionosphere,
mm-hmm.
and you're dragging them down, a much cleaner situation, and then you would trunk this up to the northern latitudes. Now, I might add that I've done this in a laboratory. there's easy to do in a laboratory. In fact,
it is. I mean, it is. I guess I had to say it that way. Come on, you're talking about demonstrating more output in a device than input, which is a claim made by many, and I, as far as I know, not demonstrated by anybody.
Well, unless our friends in the Northeast there demonstrated it by accident.
Well, all right, fine.
But yeah, it's a big operation.
But what have you done in the lab? I mean, what have you accomplished a situation in which you produced more output than input?
Well, let's put it this way. I've produced the discharge, yeah. But to have a sustainable system in a laboratory scenario, no, I cannot say that I've, produced all of this. No.
Okay. Yeah. Would you be capable of sitting right now and designing on paper or coming up with a device that would demonstrate that?
Oh, absolutely. Right. A Tesla oscillator is a tuned circuit. And so there's some variables that you have to adjust after you build it. But basically, yes, it's you would build the basic structure, and then you'd have to tune it and modify some components, like in a tuned oscillating circuit. Basically, you're matching the impedance of the coil with the
every year circuit. they have this convention, James, where everybody with a free energy device brings it by and they have it on display, and inevitably they claim more output than input, but they'll never let you look inside, James. They just never let you look inside. I mean, you can't tear it apart and say, oh my God, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never let you get that far, and that makes people like myself suspicious. I mean,
right. No, mine is very much very open. In fact, I've just described what it is, so there's no secret. There's no secret thing in there that, or element or material. It's a very basic device. It's the reason I came up with this is because I finally understood the power source that Tesla was tapping into.
All right, hold it right there. We'll break here at the top of the hour. Incredible stuff. James McCanney making some pretty incredible claims right from the very beginning of the program, actually, with what went on in Canada. Ay-yi-yi-yi-yi in the Northeast blackout to what he can do. I'm Art Bell.
Take a ride? Well, call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
Baby, we're all on this ride, and it'd be a good idea, don't you think, that we understood or the engine that's driving us around. That's what James McCanney's here for. He's a physicist, and he's telling us that what we believed about what drives the weather just ain't so. Which, by the way, accounts for why they get it wrong a pretty high percentage of the time. And actually, a lot of what's aimed at the Earth, even though deflected to a great degree by the, you know, the magnetic field that surrounds the entire Earth, actually enough gets through to be driving just about everything that's happening. It's a new way of looking at things. In a moment, we'll go to the phones. Stay right where you are. Once again, James McKinney. James, I've got a very interesting message here from J.D. Here it is. Let me see if I can read this. J.D. in Palmer, Alaska says, hey, Art and guest, if we begin to draw current from our atmosphere on, say, a commercial basis, wouldn't that reduce the Earth's ability to deflect unwanted asteroids and possibly cause the magnetic field of the Earth to weaken? Now, that's a really, really interesting question. If we started drawing energy from the atmosphere the way we draw oil now from the ground in the past and the dinosaurs, it is said, then what possible ecological effect, you know, old reverse we gotcha kind of effect could there be by doing, I mean, we burn fossil fuels and we get dirty air and we have all kinds of catastrophic problems. What if we're drawing this free energy?
Well, the situation is, and that was JD, is that it's happening all the time, all around us. We're just going to do it in a bit more organized manner. The end result is hurricanes occur. And we could be drawing that energy off the equatorial electron belts and actually, over time, reduce the amount of energy that forms in hurricanes. And so the answer is that this energy is going to come down one way or the other. We may as well use it. So to answer your question, the point of...
So you don't see any possible negative effects. I mean, you certainly, at one time, somebody made a case for, hey, all that oil's in the ground, we might as well use it.
Well, in a sense, it's the same in that if you took the energy in Hurricane Isabel, we could probably run our country for about a year off that one hurricane.
Huh. That's something to think
so,
about.
So, you know, would you rather have a year's worth of electrical power or Hurricane Isabel?
Can't argue with that. all right, to the phones we go. Let's see what we get. You never know. First time caller line, you're on the air with James McCanney in Art Bell. Hi.
Hello, this is Mel in Denver.
Denver, how are you doing?
Hi, welcome back, Art.
Thank you.
Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
James, I am a regular listener of your Thursday night shows.
Oh,
very informative, by the way.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask you is, on your last show, you speculated about NASA possibly... sending Galileo off to a mission rather than slamming that into Jupiter. And I wanted to ask you as to how you arrived at conclusion and what could be that mission that you were talking about.
Yes, James, you do believe there is a possibility, don't you, that they're lying to us, that they're not going to smash it into Jupiter, as they say, but so you continue it on some kind of secret mission?
Well, would you take a perfectly good $1.5 billion spacecraft and send it into Jupiter just because it may crash into some moons and contaminate them? Well, why not just send it off someplace else? And this has been done before, by the way. And I suspect the staff over at Goddard and JPL...
Wait a minute. You're saying they've lied to us before about crashing spacecraft into places and stuff like that?
Well, I'll give an example of one that was very much on the record, James Farquhar, who is a specialist at taking satellites and moving them into new orbits, took a satellite that was known as the ISEE-3, which is a very unknown solar... observation satellite. It crossed between the magnetosphere and the open solar wind for years.
Yes.
And monitored at Goddard Space Flight Center by a number of physicists, not very well known except people like me who may have just followed it, you know. But at any rate, as that satellite was nearing the end of its useful life, they decided to send it out. This was 1986. They sent it out to a comet called Giacobini-Zinner, and they renamed it the ICE-3 after ice. And it actually was the first satellite to reach a comet. So this technique of winding a satellite around planets and using gravitational boost to get it out of there and off to someplace more interesting is well known. When the Contour mission of last July 4th took off from, about a year ago, 2002, July 4th, there was a big fanfare, and a mission was to go out and visit three comets. And mysteriously, on the initial burn, it seemed to not appear when it came out the other side of the Earth. And NASA looked and said, oh, there's some streaks over there by the moon. That must be it. See you later. Bye. And I never bought that story.
Okay. What is it that you buy then? In other words, for example, the Galileo, what do you think they might, what do you speculate they might do with it other than crash it into Jupiter?
Well, there is a probe that will, it was designed to crash into Jupiter's upper atmosphere. Crash is probably not a good word because it's just a very thin atmosphere up there. But at any rate, there are two disks on Galileo, I think there's two, possibly one, that was designed to actually go down into the atmosphere as part of the probe. What I think they would do to answer that part of the question is send it down into the southern hemisphere, where possibly something that I suspect is down there and very difficult to see. Now, when new large comets come into the solar system way, way out there, they break the initial capacitor out there, and they form a very loose-bound cloud around them. And they're very difficult to see.
Well, wait, but there's something here I don't get. Why would they lie to us? Why not just state the additional science goal that they're trying to demonstrate? Why lie about what's happening to the spacecraft? Why? What's the motive?
Well, the motive may be that they don't want to tell us about this monster object coming in from the southern hemisphere that's bringing all these comets in that I've been seeing, and also increasing the energy of the sun.
Planet X, for a better
possibly our friend Planet X. And so this is something I've suspected all along. The early NASA studies made it very clear that there was a large object coming in from the southern region of the celestial sphere.
Let's use that as a working hypothesis for a moment. Suppose that were true. Suppose there is a large object coming in, and suppose they know about it, which would account for the reason that they're lying about these additional missions. Sort of working with that for a moment, is it your view that if the government, our government, or other governments, I would guess, knew something was out there and on the way, they're not telling us why, James? Because they think we'll panic? Because there's nothing essentially that can be done about it? Because of why?
Actually, it's a law in the United States. There is an actual law that prevents news media and the government passing information to the public, which would cause, at a certain level, a public alarm. And it's actually...
What law is that?
It came into effect probably in the early 90s, possibly even the 80s. And it is an extension of martial law, basically, of the Western Hemisphere, where, and this has to do also, for example, all of the scientists within NASA have signed non-disclosure agreements. So that's why scientists at NASA, you never see them at a press conference where they just get up and freely talk. All the information comes out of a press release, which is done through a centralized offices. JPL or Goddard or wherever, those are the two big ones.
I did have a couple of NASA guys on the show once. They never came back, though. All right, back to the lines. You're on the air with the Wildcard Line with James McCanny. Hello? 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 Hello?
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Okay.
Question for James. In your first book, I bought your book pamphlet back in January. And actually, I talked to George Norrie at the end of February and asked when he was going to have you on. And he said he never heard of you, and you're on a couple weeks later, so it's good to hear you on. Art, on Saturday morning.
Happy to be here, sir.
The oil and petroleum, I read in your book, you said that it comes from outer space.
Yes.
You did. You did. James, you said that?
Yes. And, for example, you know, the standard story is that the oil is a residue from fern forest that grew millions of years ago.
And dinosaurs and stuff, yeah.
Right, exactly. But where were the fern forests that grew under the oceans? We have vast deposits of oil under the oceans. And so where were the fern forests that created that oil? And the second point regarding that was not my original idea, but pointed out many times, is no chemist has ever shown how you take decomposed plant life from dirt basically, and you form oil. And if that were the case, we might have a new industry.
All right, having said that, you still haven't told us how it came from.
Okay, yes, but the situation is that hydrocarbons are very much a part of comet tails. And the big comets, not the little poofy ones like Halley's or Hale-Bopp, was a significant comet and would have had significant amount of hydrocarbons in the tail. But the really big comets, which have frequented this solar system and which have encountered Earth on past occasions,
mm-hmm.
and in fact have been the source of the oil, in fact, are, if you listen to any account of the ancient texts, including many people believe in the Bible, the Old Testament, the rain of brimstone and fire, the naphtha, that's where the word naphtha originally came from, pouring in from outside the planet and being ignited by the rocks, the meteor streams that came in at the same time. And so literally the hydrocarbons came in from outer space. They form from the hydrogen and carbon atoms, which are freely floating throughout our solar system, and are part of my comet model, which says that the material in the comet tail is being attracted to the comet nucleus. See, what we have not experienced in this solar system is a really big comet. And frankly, I hope we don't. But if we do, you will see this kind of thing.
So you are contending then that oil, petroleum, got in our ground as a result of comets impacting Earth.
Not impacting. Just coming by. Okay.
What's the mechanism that causes the oil from them just coming by?
Well, if we had passed through the tail of Hale-Bopp,
yes,
it would have taken us about 20 days. Now, if you spend that amount of time in a comet tail, you're going to absorb whatever is there. And now, astronomers like to point out, for example, that Earth passed through Halley's Comet tail in 1910. But like I say, Halley's Comet is a little poofball.
Yeah.
It's a little nothing. I'm talking about a big comet.
All right. But what is the assumption that oil got deposited here or created a condition that made the oil here? What are you saying?
No, the hydrocarbons form just like the water forms in a comet tail from hydrogen and oxygen that's freely floating in the
yes.
solar environment,
okay.
out in the solar system.
And so it gets what? Just absorbed by Earth?
When they are pulled together in the electrical stream of the comet tail, they form. They form the hydrocarbons, and it forms the oil. It's part of the cometary process, and it's being dragged into the main comet. If we pass through this, we are going to encounter that. We have our own, we would become part of that comet, part of the electrical discharge. And the way this works is you get a negative charging on the nucleus. We would do that. And in fact, we would start sucking in the material from this comet tail.
Sucking in the material.
Just like the comet
tail. In other words, virtually absorbed into our atmosphere.
Right. And there again, that's where the 40 days of rain come from in the biblical sense, because we encountered a large comet.
But if your theory is true, then every now and then we would encounter a large comet and our oil supplies would be replenished.
We'd have plenty to burn again. Now, in the Mideast, when they first started using oil back in the 1200s, They were building tarred roads. This stuff was laying on the ground.
Do you realize how far out on a limb you are from traditional astronomy and physics here? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
You're way out there on the twig.
Right. But if you come back and you break that one little scientific principle, let's say, that the solar system is electrically neutral, the cascade of theories on the other side, the traditional side, all fall down.
Yeah, I can see that.
And they all get replaced. And that's what this hinges on is, in fact, astronomers have witnessed and measured that there is an excess current of protons in the solar wind.
Okay, we've got a lot of people here. I've got to pay attention to them. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Dave from Bryan, Texas.
Hello, Dave.
And bless you, Art, and bless you, Jim.
Thank you.
Got a question about turning the energy that can be derived from the atmosphere to hydrolyze water and make the hydrogen that we need for fueling our machines.
That's a pretty good question. In other words, hydrogen requires power to have it made, right?
Right.
And so he's talking about using the kind of energy you're talking about, James, to power that process.
To separate water, yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Of course, every time you use another process, there's an inefficiency there.
We've got lots of energy.
But, absolutely, you could create hydrogen fuel by that process, by electrical separation, and burn it in the engine or whatever. Yes. In fact, right now, I don't know if you know it, but they're selling hydrogen fuel at a gas station pump in Iceland. They're selling it as a fuel up there.
I want to produce it on my own land from wind.
Well, any way you can produce electricity, you can produce hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Just be careful with it. take a look at the picture of the Hindenburg,
Well, that was from the aluminum paint, not from hydrogen. They've shot incendiary bullets into hydrogen tanks, and they don't go off.
Well, I wouldn't want to be near one, but actually it is like gasoline. It can be made into a safe fuel.
It's so light that it escapes from every pore.
Yeah, I'd be inclined not to try that test myself. However, surely his first point was a pretty good one, that you could use that energy to drive that process, couldn't you?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Yes, good morning, guys. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Art. This is Jamie calling from Medford, Oregon, station KMED.
Yes, sir.
All right. My question is this. This is going back to the beginning of your program. It has to do with Tesla and broadcast power. What do you or possibly your guests think about the fact that maybe I see this on television on the network news, the guys walking around with these floppy antennas on their backs? Do you think that perhaps there might be some broadcast power at like 30 cycles per second that is powering those devices that they're working with?
What guys are you talking about?
The gentlemen, they're walking around, they're communication specialists, and they have these floppy antennas on their backs.
Yeah, but that's usually for transmitting, right?
They're for transmitting and sending.
Uh-huh.
And if they used a 30-cycle-a-second Tesla-powered device, they wouldn't have those heavy batteries to carry around on their knapsacks or something.
Right? Oh, sure. In other words, is that a reasonable power source for that, right?
Yeah. Let me make a comment about transmitting, which is one of Tesla's ideas, of course, was to transmit without wire.
Yes.
And you can do that. You can hold a fluorescent light bulb across the room from an active Tesla coil, and it'll light up.
Yep.
But it's not a good idea at the power levels we're using today. To transmit all this power through the atmosphere.
That's an interesting point. We'd be frying people right and left, I suppose.
Yes, because it would be directed. It would be used by a certain, source, and we'd have birds falling out of the air and, other things like that. It's not a good idea, knowing what we know today.
There's a lot of people that have fits about birds falling out of the air, believe me. All right, James.
People falling out of the...
That'd be even worse, yeah. James McCanny is my guest from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
You know, what you heard from James McKenna tonight, from the mainstream point of view is way over the top. However, if you listen carefully to what he is suggesting, it's not so over the top in the sense that conventional science just can't explain where all this energy is coming from. They sort of say, oh, we don't know. Well, James is trying to explain that, so it's definitely worth your consideration, because it's got to be coming from somewhere. You know, as I suggested, a lot of it will appear to many of you as way over the top, but enough of you, I think, will probably be intrigued to wish to read more about what Mr. McKenna is saying. James, what would you recommend, what reading would you recommend of what you have written? What should people go grab up to know more after tonight?
Well, what I've done for the show, and I do this regularly, is to reduce the price of my two-book set. And the second book, Atlantis to Tesla, is you wouldn't understand it, basically, unless you read the first book. And so I like people to read both of them. And so normally they're like $37.95, including postage.
We haven't even named your first book yet. What was that?
Which is Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes.
All right.
And so that's the first book.
And Atlantis to Tesla, the second.
The second book.
And together, the very special Coast to Coast AM price is?
Is $28.
Well, that is a good buy.
That includes shipping.
Okay. How did they get it?
And there's two ways to do that. The 800 number, which is active, 800-289-2891.
Okay. People are really slow on numbers. You know, half of them are half asleep right now next to their bed and stuff, and they're turning on the light. So that number is 1-800-289-2891. And that's live right now?
That is live right now. And
okay.
The price is $28 for the two-book set. And people can mention that if they want the pamphlet, they could add, I believe it's $5 for the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet.
Okay.
And through the 800 number. The other way is by mail order, and that's to the address JMCC, just those four letters, JMCC, P.O. Box 5858. Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E. Minnesota is M-N.
Good thing, too. Most people can't spell it.
I know, unless you're Native American from Minnesota.
Yeah, so, and then the zip code?
Is 55392.
All right. A little unfinished business, James. You made a statement going into a break that, you know, about trailer parks and tornadoes truly getting attracted to trailer parks.
Yes.
We never got to why that is.
Well, there again, it's electrical, and the tornadoes are similar to the hurricane in that you have an electrical current that comes down through the cloud, down to ground. And what's happening is the ionized air is rushing up that funnel. That's why the tornado sucks, so to speak, like a big vacuum cleaner. And something has to continue energizing this process.
Yes.
And so literally the current is from the cloud is attaching to ground, and it's a much bigger current than normal. That's why you see a lot of lightning around tornadoes. But the situation is as follows. I've proposed that southwest of the cities, say in Oklahoma, where you get a tremendous number of tornadoes,
uh-huh.
you place basically large metal boxes, aluminum boxes,
Uh-huh. Decoy trailer parks.
Decoy trailer parks.
And so they're going to go right for those things,
and
right?
And you basically ground it out.
Oh, I see. Well, your theory is solid. Whether it's a hurricane or a tornado, you're coming down to the same place, though, right?
But now I want to caution with the tornadoes. Now, a hurricane is out at sea.
Yep.
So if you mess up, well, you know, it's out at sea. With a tornado,
yep,
if you, instead of decrease the energy but enhance it, then now you just created a bigger problem because you created a much nicer ground for that tornado to tap into. Mm. So now I'm not suggesting this as a way of reducing the energy in tornadoes. I'm saying it will definitely attract that tornado to that spot, and that would happen. But whether we could find a way then to, once we've trapped the tornado,
mm-hmm,
to reduce its energy, that would be the second question.
Well, even if you could just attract it, James, you'd have done your civic duty. I mean, it wouldn't be hitting the real trailer park. It would be hitting the fake one.
You could put a fake one out there. Right?
That's crazy.
But, so it's really literally, and this is an old joke, of course. That they,
yeah, I know it is.
They,
right.
And it's really.
But it would only be old trailer parks, because you see, modern trailers are made out of typical construction materials and wood and all the rest of that. So it'd be the only, the old ones where
the
they have these
ones.
Metal trailers, right?
Exactly.
Damnest thing I've ever heard. All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McKinney. Hello. Oh, I didn't push the button. I'm sorry. Now you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Yes, Art. My name is Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, and I'm actually a researcher for Richard Hoagland on occasion.
Okay.
And I have a document that came out a while back when you had a power outage that went on in Nevada.
Oh, yes.
And the Pahrump one and the Las Vegas one.
Yes.
What's very interesting about it is it's dated December 22nd, 1999. It occurred at 6:25 p.m. Lasted for 4 hours and 57 minutes.
Yes, I remember.
And it's listed as Las Vegas, Pahrump, Nevada, and Military Base Area 51, right on the document.
Yeah, I think that's true.
In addition to that, what it also says is that the...
Well, you're not about to give away anything that's going to get us in trouble, are you? I mean, classified information. If you are...
No.
Okay.
What I was going to say is that this... It's mentioning that the effect areas was long distance, special services, and military circuits,
yep,
known at this time.
You are correct, yes.
And the cause of the incident was circuit breaker was turned off. Full details unknown at this time. More details to follow.
I am aware of this report, sir. I've heard this information. And your point is?
And I was just wondering, well, it mentioned about it was causing 8 DS3 circuits to fail. Our lines to fail.
Right.
And I was just wondering if it might be related to what was going on in the Northeast as well. And if that's any type of connection.
Okay. Yeah. Certainly, thank you. It's a very reasonable question. We had a very notorious power failure, James, as he just noted.
Mm-hmm.
He also noted the areas affected, Las Vegas, the adjacent military base from Nevada here where I live in Area 51, or the test site area, whatever you want to call it. I don't think they like Area 51, the test site will say. And he's saying, could this have been some sort of experiment, obviously implying it would have been at Area 51, similar to the one that you talked about in Canada?
Well, actually, I monitor power outages around the country.
It's, oh, you do?
Something I do as one of the things I do. And I have detailed, 24/7 monitoring of that, but
gotcha.
Actually that area and Area 51 and Roswell and all those areas have regular power outages, although there have been some unusual ones. And in fact, the one that covered about the 10-state region, remember, it started in Roswell. This was about 1996.
I of course remember. I was,
and it extended up all the way to Vancouver.
Yeah.
That started in our little town of Roswell. So to answer the question, I can't say, specifically.
One way or the other, but it does sound similar, doesn't it?
It does make one wonder.
In yet another interesting area. Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKinney. Hello.
Yes. Am I on?
You are indeed.
Yeah, I want to make a comment about the oil fields That's a misknown fact there. That's dinosaurs and ferns and stuff like that. That they're responsible for the coal. They're not responsible for most of the oil. The oil is from plankton and from organic sediments that have settled down to the depths of the ocean in an anaerobic environment. Where
all right, James, what about that as an alternative? You don't buy that, do you?
No, I do not. The fact that, for example, we have coal deposits 3 miles underground soaked with oil tells you that Earth has undergone some tremendous changes, and this is the type of thing that led people like Ignatius Donnelly, who grew up in the coal fields of Pennsylvania, to consider alternative sources for both the coal and the oil.
All right, but the oil. See, here's the part I don't get. I heard your theory about how the oil got here. Okay, fine. But how does it get underground, pressurized, and all that? How does it get from a comet into our atmosphere and then underground?
Well, there again, we've gone through some major Earth changes. And, of course, my first book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, deals with all of the changes that occur to Earth when a large object comes by. Not only do we gain oil, we can be hit by a large gravitational wave, which disrupts the mantle, folds the mantle, part of it over the another part, creates mountain building. So there's a tremendous number of Earth changes that occur when this happens, one of which is we drag in a bunch of oil and water and things like that. So the answer is that Earth has undergone incredible changes in its history. And these have happened from outside intervention, so to speak, from large objects passing by, not hitting us, but passing by. Not that we haven't been hit also with objects, but the main cause of these are these large comets that we have not witnessed in our scientific history and which modern astronomers deny exist. But even Hale-Bopp, when it came in, they were very surprised that anything could be that big and be a comet. So, and I think Hale-Bopp is the little brother of some of the big ones.
The Hopi, of course, think there'll be a precursor event,
right?
Comet, and then the big mother.
Right, that's right.
Okay, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKenney. Hello.
Hi, Art. Jeff from San Bernardino, land of KFI, the land of KNAR. Glad your back is back, and therefore so are you.
Yes, well, it's wonderful, isn't it, that because KFI, as program director, I'll make KFI as program director, encouraged me to do this. They are now, of course, carrying the show throughout the weekend.
Hooray.
Yeah.
Glad you're on the weekends now.
Pretty cool.
It is. It's beyond cool. It's
anyway, what's up?
It's mysterious and very reassuring. James, I'd like to know on the American Meteorological Society, I understand they're changing the F rating concerning hurricane severity, and I wonder what your take is on that, also in relation to El Nino and their claim of that being the engine, so to speak, for the movement of the jet stream and actually fueling the jet stream. And a little aside on the trailer parks, would that make them capacitor parks, transistor parks, diode parks, or something else?
Okay.
Capacitor parks.
There we go.
Inductor parks. But anyway, regarding El Nino, El Nino has nothing to do with Atlantic hurricane formation or control. As we were talking about, the air stream, the current streams, all the streams of energy flow move westerly. And so El Nino is a Central Pacific situation. And in fact, what El Nino is dual heating of the Pacific Ocean, where in the Atlantic you have Africa, where the storms can build up and then roll off and form the hurricanes. You don't really have that in the Pacific. You find these weak storms building and rolling up off of Central America, but you don't have that big land mass to create the storm systems that then can roll out into the Pacific. So what happens in the Pacific, since it's so large, it takes up half of the world when you look at it, the electrical current, and like the one caller was asking, what's going to happen if we drain this energy, it's coming down anyway, and it's heating up the Pacific Ocean. When you look at the real true nature of El Nino, where I've seen it in a two-day period heat up 4 degrees C centigrade. In a how do you heat the Pacific Ocean 4 degrees centigrade in 2 days?
Well, this is why I think what you're suggesting has merit perhaps across the board. I'm not sure if all of it is so. I'm still a little stuck on the oil thing. I'm not sure I buy that. But, you know, your whole presentation of the electrical manipulation of weather systems, that makes sense. But I can get my teeth into that. First time caller line, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Jim of Los Angeles, KRI. I've been listening to you since 1991.
Yes, sir.
And I have a couple of points. I've got a better solution for James McKinney, but I was also going to point out to you that I was at Carswell in Roswell 4648. I was a top secret cryptographic technician, and I'd like to get on your program sometime.
Well, then you send me an email. Art Bell at Mindspring.com. You send me an email. Art Bell at Mindspring.
Is there any chance of sending you some mail?
There's all kinds of chance of that, yes, but send me an email.
Yeah, okay. I've been listening to you for 12 years. I've solved the chaos problem. Are you familiar with that, Mandelbrot?
The what problem?
The chaos.
I'm familiar with chaos theory.
Yeah, well, I've solved that. I've solved the mystery of chaos.
All right. Well, that's a lot to do with not a lot of time here.
Point. I've also invented a black hole, which I think will handle hurricanes and tornadoes much
better. Black hole handle all of Earth. You better be careful about black holes.
Wait a minute. I have a mathematical model.
All right. Listen, sir. Do you have a question for my guest?
Well, I would just ask him what would happen if he could put a black hole inside of a tornado or a hurricane.
All right. Well, James, you want to try and tackle that one?
Well, theoretically, it would take us and everything else along with it.
That was always my impression about
black
holes.
We would cure the problem.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And out goes the baby with the bathwater, right?
Yes.
And the baby is Mother Earth. Wow. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello. Hello, hello. Going once, going twice, gone. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, Art. Good to talk to you. This is really Bruce out in like Denver, Colorado.
Yes, sir.
And my question for James is, one of the problems with the ice ages in Earth's history is they're not uniform on the North Pole. The ice caps mainly were on the North American continent, but not on the Asian continent. And then there's been no elucidated mechanism that would deposit that enormous amount of ice and then stop depositing it.
Yes, absolutely. And my first book talks about that, but the second book goes into far more detail where I identify the old North Pole as somewhere north of the state of Michigan. And that would be the center pretty much of the Laurentian ice cap, which they call the Laurentian Shield, but at the time, Siberia was very tropical. So basically what happened was a pole shift. The continent of Antarctica, in fact, was in a tropical climate, and the old South Pole was in the South Indian Ocean near an island called McDonald Island.
I was wishing to ask you about the possibility of pole change. I have a story on that here, but we can save that for a future program. We are out of time.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
How does that happen?
It just, you know, when you're having fun, it just happens, actually. So, you know, one more time, you've got two books on sale, $28, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, as well as Atlantis to Tesla. And everybody, here's the phone number one more time, 1-800-289-2891. That's 1-800-289-2891, and that is even open right now, I guess. And it has been a pleasure having you here, James. Thank you.
Art, welcome back from everyone.
It's great to be back. And so thanks for being here, and depend on the fact that you and I will do this again.
Absolutely.
Good night.
Good night.
And good night to you all. I'll see you tomorrow night, actually. Tomorrow night. That feels good to say. The weekend guy here. From the high desert. Good night. One, two, three.
in the